Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 125 of Through the Years, the podcast that reviews Ring of Honor show by show from the beginning. My name, as always, is Trevor Dame. It has not changed. Joined, as always, by the co-captain, Matt Feuerstein. And we have a very special first-time guest on the show. So we probably mentioned this literal years ago. We've been doing this over half a decade. But you know what? It's time to bring it up one more time because you want a little piece of Through the Years lore. Matt and I, we met each other when we were literal baby teenagers, where we were learning, you know, going through puberty, learning about our bodies, learning about math, and mostly learning about the world of professional wrestling. Some of us never leave that last stage, unfortunately. And yeah, we would post on forums, we would chat in AOL instant messengers, and we had like a large contingent, you know, future luminaries. Like the Cubs fan used to post there. I booked him in an ETH-head I ran for like 2 weeks. But there was four of us, a special group that we used to chat for like years, and you know, literally the funniest, smartest guys I knew. Nice little part growing up, you know, late 90s, early 2000s. And we've had, you know, one was Matt Feuerstein. One was me. One was the great Justin Shapiro, who's been on multiple times. And one was our guest today, who, unlike all the slime we've had on this show that mostly comes from the world of professional wrestling, the scum of the earth, finally has someone that's classing it up, a literal journalist, man who works for marketing for the comic book industry now, eat your heart out, Joe Sposto. You know, if the four of us were the Beatles, I'd probably have been Ringo, Matt, you're George, which, by the way, means that one day you're going to sleep with my wife, which I'll be grateful for because that means I'll have a wife.
And I'll get Justin, I'll get to have sex.
It's a win-win, and somewhat of a bit of loss for me. Justin was probably I'll go Paul.
Win-win loss. And it's a new game that we sit around in a circle and do.
And anyway, our guest today, probably my favorite Albert, which doesn't seem like much of a compliment until you realize my dad's name was Albert. His mother once sent me his copy of Fire Pro Wrestling Returns upon my request. Ladies and gentlemen, the best intro I've ever given, Albert Ching. It's great to finally, after so many episodes, after 125 episodes, have you on the show.
What a thrill. So great to be talking with you both. It's funny, I had in my notes a few, like, must mentions, and one of the first ones was mother mailing Trevor my copy of Fire Pro Wrestling Returns. So we're off to a good start. We're already on the same page, and it really does feel like a full circle moment from when you called into my college radio show in probably the year, we won't say the year because we don't want people to know how old we are. We need to seem ageless and eternally youthful, you know, to keep everyone invested. But it was a long time ago, even longer ago than the show that we're going to be talking about imminently.
Sadly, people already know how old I am if they are listening. And yeah, it's just very sad. And it's very exciting and happy to have you here, Albert. When it comes to mailing things to each other, you and I are the pros at it.
Oh, yeah. We used to mail TNA wrestling pay-per-views to each other between the years of, I'd say, 2005 and 2006.
I might have even made you like an ROH comp tape at one point.
That sounds very plausible and also very nice and very generous of your time. So thank you for doing it. And even though I don't remember it, if it did happen, I'm sure I watched it and enjoyed it.
And we decided, as we were talking about this right before recording, we decided to, you know, really save something special for Albert's first show. This was a show, you know, Albert is on because Matt took him to his first Ring of Honor show, the show we are going to cover tonight, a show that upon rewatching, I have decided, I'm not even going to bury the lead. This is the worst show we've covered in the history of Through the Years. I fucking hate this show. And that show is The Bitter End, which is a great, almost ends this podcast, quite frankly. It's an appropriate name. It took place November 4th, 2006, at the Pennsylvania National Guard Armory in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, in front of a reported crowd of, I'll say, 625 fans, because like the previous night's show, the Observer on one issue said 600 fans, another said 650, so we're going to split the difference like we did on that show.
Trevor, your anger at this show leads me to believe that you possibly had never seen it before.
Oh, I have, but my memory is so bad. It's the best and worst thing. Seventh is probably not the first time I've had to say this. This is probably not the first time I've had to say this about a show we've covered up through the years. Remembered it was racist. Did not remember how racist. And yeah, we'll get into it. But so yeah, a little note on the attendance. This was Ring of Honor's first Philly show after the CZW feud, which ended at Death Before Dishonor 4. And it, you know, that had really helped the market, the CZW feud. And this show really illustrates that, because Death Before Dishonor 4's attendance was 1,100. They were down to 625 here on the very next show after the feud ends. So, I think that was the lowest Philly attendance since maybe the Homecoming show that had Christopher Daniels and CM Punk go to the 60-minute draw. Over a year earlier. But ROH wasn't the only promotion having trouble in Philly, because this is a little note I have that from a show that happened a week later. Matt, you could have taken Albert to this show instead. We'll see if he would have liked this better. We'll go to the Observer TNA section. Dave wrote at the time, the other weekend show for TNA took place November 10th, so about a week after this show, at the old ECW Arena in Philadelphia for TNA, drew only 500 fans, even with Kurt Angle working the main event and with direct plugs for the house shows for the first time ever on the Impact TV broadcast. That's less than the crowd that Ring of Honor drew 6 days earlier, told they overpriced themselves with cheapest seats at $35 and good seats from $50 to $125. I actually looked up the card. I was like, what was the show that got outdrew by Ring of Honor? It's actually like a somewhat appealing card. I guess they co-promoted it with a promotion called UWF. They called it the Return to Philadelphia. This is your card for that show. This is the show you could have taken, Matt. You could have taken Albert to this. Petey Williams beat Sanjay Dutt in 736. Eric Young beat Brother Runt. That's, of course, Spike Dudley in 924. America's Most Wanted defeated the James Gang, you know, the renamed New Age Outlaws, 11 minutes and 2 seconds. False Count Anywhere match, Samoa Joe defeated Rhino in 1502. Senshi, that's old Low Key, beat Jay Lethal. That's a match we've seen before, 858. For the NWA World Tag Team Titles, he could have seen a NWA Tag Team Title match. The Latin American Exchange of Hernandez and Homicide beat AJ Styles and Christopher Daniels in 1214. And your main event, Kurt Angle beat Abyss in 1242. So that's an interesting card in the sense that it seemed like they picked, like, they took their roster, like, apart from maybe the James game, we're like, well, what's going to appeal to indie wrestling fans? A lot of Ring of Honor names, past and present. And they drew 500 people. So, yeah, that's kind of insane.
Well, isn't it possible that people who went to this show were so angry about professional wrestling that they decided they were not even going to go to TNA? They were like, well, wrestling's bad now, I guess, so I guess we shouldn't go to any wrestling shows anymore. If that's how bad Ring of Honor was, then imagine how bad TNA is going to be.
Yeah. I'm just looking at my notes quick. We have one other note. This is the last show we will ever do, Matt. For Jared David, MSL these days, you know, works for MLW. The PW Torch simply wrote at the time, Jared David has left ROH as an announcer due to scheduling conflicts. So I think that we both agree he did a good job as a fill-in. Like, he was actually pretty darn good, you know.
And it was interesting to hear in like these later shows that how like he starts letting his personality come out. It took him a while. He was kind of like just like replacement announcer who did a respectable job, and then by like these most recent shows he's like, I hate this wrestler, and like just like saying all sorts of wacky stuff. It was kind of amusing to see him grow right before he left. Is Lenny Leonard back on the next show, or is there like a gap in between?
No, Matt, the dry winter of ROH will, well, let's not, we've always thought that people were a little hard on him, but no, for the next four shows it's Prazak and Gabe.
Ah, nice. I actually appreciate that. I miss Gabe on commentary. I genuinely do. One time I even had a debate with him on Twitter about how he wasn't that bad. And I was the one arguing that he wasn't bad. So I think I'm actually looking forward to that. After this show, it could only go up.
And finally, before we get to the show proper, pre-show matches that did not make the DVD, they were reported by Brian Strelekis at the PW Torch at the time. You know, he could not even get these on Cage Match. We do the digging, as usual. Two of them, Bobby Dempsey and Rhett Titus, beat Matt Turner and Alex Payne. Brian wrote, Dempsey, the large ROH student, was quite over as the fat kid and got the one with a splash. And then your second pre-show match, that would be Apocalypse, a.k.a. WWE's Victor from The Ascension. He beat Mitch Franklin. Brian wrote, Apocalypse defeated Little Mitch with a pile driver from a razor's edge position that the crowd really dug. Decent match. And that brings us to the DVD, which...
Well, wait, before you start the DVD, I want to talk a little bit about my memories of this because, I don't know, I'm actually want to compare them with what Albert remembers because I know that this was the first time that Albert had ever stayed with me at my parents' house in Staten Island. And just a little note for any New York pizza heads. As soon as we got there, he met me at my office at the time in Manhattan. We went back on the Staten Island ferry because I wanted to give him, a real experience. And I took him to Danino's. So if anyone knows anything about New York pizza, that's one of the spots in Staten Island. That's one of the destinations. Albert, do you remember any of this?
I remember meeting you at your office. I remember pizza, but go on.
So Albert had...
We've eaten pizza, multiple times. I don't know if I remember the specific place or not, but maybe there's more detail coming.
I know one time I met you while you were eating pizza at Famous Famiglia's, and you were really excited to note that they had a note on the wall that said that the Cosby Mysteries had been filmed there.
I was about to say, I remember one of the places that, yes, a sign that said the Cosby Mysteries, which was, I don't know, a one season...
The
post Cosby show, Bill Cosby series.
Yes,
they seemed very proud of it. The show was already off the air for at least, I would say 12 years by that point, and not revered. And of course, it is worth noting that back then the public perception of Bill Cosby was different.
I remember the Cosby Mysteries mainly from the SNL sketch where Adam Sandler did a Cosby impression. I don't even know if that would be allowed anymore, but it was then, and that's the main thing I remember about the Cosby Mysteries because I definitely never watched the show. But it holds a special place in my heart because of what happened between us at the pizzeria. So that's and I also remember. Yet we took a road trip to Philadelphia. It was about, an hour and a half. And that was probably the on the way there and on the way back, just chatting with Albert in the car, listening to music. That was the highlight of the whole thing. Would you agree?
I'm sure it was great. I don't remember specifically.
Yeah, I guess what I'm trying to say is, do you think the show was a fond memory?
Well, it's funny, speaking of the, entire experience of, me flying out, I was living in Tempe, Arizona at the time where I'm from, which is in the Phoenix area. And, the whole experience of, and we had met a few times already. So, but the whole experience, I was trying to think about it. I was trying to put myself back in that November 2006 mode. And I was like, I wonder if I can find any documents from that time, anything that to really narrow down a snapshot of that experience. And I did find an email that I would like to read. Don't worry, it's very short. It's only one sentence from Matt Feuerstein to me sent Thursday, November 2nd, 2006 at 5:38 a.m., which I presume was 8:38 Eastern time or something like that. Here's the email. Hey, I just wanted to remind you to bring warm clothes, if you have any, because it's set to be pretty chilly this weekend. Which was a very nice reminder. And since I was from the desert, it wasn't unreasonable to think that I didn't have warm clothes.
I love that Matt had wholesome mom energy even back then.
Even though he was, he would think he'd be full of attitude in his early 20s. And no, it was very kind and nurturing.
I was going to say, it was Matt, the person whose car had to, they had to do the announcement during the show. It's a spoiler, we'll get to it, of a car that needed to be moved. During this show, and that is the 11th most embarrassing thing that happens during the show.
But it's like, I mean, I guess we're just burying, I mean, no, now we're burying the lead. We're just like, spoiling everything we're going to say later. But yeah, that's just like a good, like, it's just emblematic of how cursed this show was. Like that on top of everything, this is the only show we've ever seen where they have to interrupt a match and anger the actual wrestlers by asking someone to move their car. And I guess I'll say now, I almost am wondering if like Cornette was really leaving at that point. Like, and he was like, my car is blocked in. It's gotta be.
Yeah. I imagined him just racing to get out. It was like the time I went to a WCW Nitro and like, my parents and me were like, my parents took me in. I was younger and they were like, you know, they always were like, we got to beat the rush. We got to leave like before the show's really even over. And I was like, God, mom and dad, you're embarrassing me. Like everyone's sticking around to see if something happens. And as we got outside, the only people out there were us and Booker T, who was just racing to leave. He was like, oh, he left even before everyone else. It's like, so I wonder if Jim Cornette was like, he's like, you know what? I'm going to park the car. Like at the door, I'm going to double park this. As soon as I say a lot of racist things, we're going to leave and get out of here. Finally, this devil's bargain is over. But yeah, so I guess we should get to the show. We open with Samoa Joe backstage. He says they call Bryan Danielson smart, yet he hasn't learned. Some call him the best in the world, yet he's been bested. Joe says tonight they'll face off in a dream partner tag match. Joe introduces his dream tag partner, someone who has taken everything Bryan has to give and given back. Nigel McGuinness. Nigel says he'll take any chance to get back in the ring with Bryan and that it'll be a pleasure. Joe also points out that he's heard this is Kenta's last night in Ring of Honor and he'll be sad to see him go, but he has a little going away gift for him and his buddy Zenoa. And Joe walks away as the camera looks to Nigel, and Nigel looks very perplexed, almost troubled, like, what's this Joe up to? So a typical good short little Samoa Joe promo, which on this show puts it high on the list of good segments. That brings us to the opening match. Christopher Daniels, escorted to the ring by Allison Danger, who gets a rare chant before the match. Again, one of the rare good things about this show. He defeats Matt Cross via pinfall in 8 minutes, 36 seconds after he hits the Angel's Wings. Doesn't eat them. After he eats some buffalo wings.
Matt Cross ate the Angel's Wings based on like the vernacular people typically use, right? You hit
exactly.
You eat the move, right? Yeah. This was Matt Cross's second match in ROH. Am I right about that?
Yes. I think he was in like a multi-man. Yeah.
Yeah, his first singles match. So really, in some ways, kind of his debut as far as like really getting to show off what he could do. Allison Danger is in a cheerleader outfit and has pom-poms for some reason. And I don't really understand why, but I guess, I don't know, if she likes them. That's fine. So you know that I've been pretty hard on Daniels in his singles matches in this era of ROH. And I always find them pretty boring. And so I actually think this was one of my favorite Daniels matches in a while, which makes it one of the best things on the show. It was simple, structured, nothing too excited, but I thought it was entertaining the whole way through. And definitely the crowd was hotter for this than they were for a lot of the other matches on the show. It's a lot of Daniels trying to ground Matt Cross, and Matt Cross just like doing his wacky athletic stuff. You know, he lands on his feet after being pulled out of the corner. He teases that dive where instead he like bounces his shoulders off the rope back into the ring. Like that's a, you know, one of his trademarks. Does that flagpole splash to the floor, like right in like the first 2 minutes of the match, he does all that stuff. So that gets the crowd going. I think Daniels picked up his pace to keep up with Cross, which is good. And then, like, Daniels basically worked, you know, almost like the veteran heel. You know, he's not really being a heel, but he's allowing himself to get heat on Matt Cross. And then Cross does a comeback. He avoids the best moonsault ever and hits the jumping Rana off the middle rope. And then, he does a really good space flying tiger drop, and the crowd really goes nuts for that. And springboard double stomp, that was pretty cool, too. And then I was just thinking, so there was a spot where Daniels blocked an O'Connor roll and caught a leapfrog into the Death Valley driver, and that's when he hit the Angel's Wings and got the win. And I feel like if this was 2024, Cross would have kicked out of that, and Daniels would have had to hit, like, another Angel's Wings for the win. But back in 2006, they were still really protecting finishers. But yeah, I thought this was fine, and I really have no complaints about it.
Albert, so this is your first, I guess, I don't know if you guys made it for the pre-show, but your first main card taste of Ring of Honor action. What did you think about this? I have to imagine Matt was just tapping you on the back saying, let me introduce you to this wonderful world, and then saying, hey, I bought you a scarf because I was worried if you might be cold, and yeah. Then you got to see this match.
Yeah, I don't think we did see the dark matches, Matt. Does that sound correct?
I honestly don't remember because I've been to this venue so many times and I know I've seen dark matches there, but I don't know if we saw them on this night.
Yeah. I remembered this as being a perfectly nice opening match. And then I watched it this past week and I had the same thought. It's definitely what, like probably like 8 minutes or so. It's just nice, fairly fast paced. Matt Cross looked great. I think it was probably the first time I had ever seen him wrestle in any form, live or taped.
You hadn't been to PWG at all yet at this point, right?
I had not. No, I didn't go to my first PWG until 2008. Battle of Los Angeles 2008. Sorry for people who don't know the parlance. If there's any, you know, people who only like Ring of Honor and don't know anything about PWG.
Little mom and pop promotion for the townies and the locals in California.
Right, exactly. For us West Coast weirdos out here in Holly Weird. perfectly nice match. And I was also curious. I actually was going to ask the two of you. I was like, did Allison Danger always dress like a cheerleader? It doesn't seem to fit the aesthetic of the Christopher Daniels Fallen Angel thing. And I'm glad to know it was just a weird thing. And yes. I also wasn't sure, like, you know, storyline wise, what their relationship is supposed to be. Like, is she just his manager? Because they also seem somewhat affectionate to each other, but not enough to, like, definitively mean that they're supposed to be romantically involved. I wasn't sure exactly what that pairing was all about. But yeah, it was a fun, nice opener.
Do they ever say that Allison Danger and Daniels are romantically involved? I feel like they at least never overtly say that. Basically, like when Daniels was a heel years earlier and she was like the main manager of the Prophecy, she was a lot more involved. And now in this recent era, she just like she's still with him, but they basically don't have her do anything. Like she barely ever even talks during this era. It's really weird, honestly. It's just like, oh, you used to be with me, so just stay, but you're just actually just kind of there. And sometimes if the crowd's quiet, she'll bang the mat. And like that's really was her entire role during Daniels matches in this era. Yeah, I agree. If it seems strange and random, it was, I guess is what I'll say.
So I agree with you, both you guys, on this match. I wouldn't say this was a sprint in terms of how the match was paced, but it was, you know, fairly lively. And I would say, like, because of its shorter length, this was, like you said, Matt, one of the more enjoyable Christopher Daniels singles matches we've seen on the show recently. Like, the offense was about 50-50, and because it was 8 minutes instead of 15, it didn't really have a chance to meander like some of Daniels' singles matches have at was lately. You know, Cross was just trying to break into Ring of Honor at this point, and Daniels is kind of like a blank canvas at times just to showcase his really impressive athleticism. Like you said, Matt, he hits most of his trademark moves here, the flagpole splash, the really nice spaceline tiger drop, springboard double stomp. And normally I'd say like an 8 minute match that doesn't really have like a lot of personality or color or story might not be the best way for a lot of wrestlers breaking in to try and make a first impression. Cause we've seen a lot of matches like that but you know, guys are just rushing moves and, you know, they don't really leave an impression, but I feel like Matt Cross is one of the few guys in that opportunity that can make an impression because his offense is so crisp and he hits like four really cool moves that even though he's only in an 8 minute match, I think if you're a fan, like coming to the show, you would walk away having never seen him before going, oh yeah, that Matt Cross guy, you know, pretty cool. He does some pretty cool stuff here. I'm going to remember him. So overall, I thought this was, yeah, like a fine little above average, perfectly nice little opener as a way for Cross to dip his toe into a Ring of Honor. So after the match, Chris Hero and Claudio Castagnoli run in from the crowd. They attack Daniels and Cross. Cross gets kicked to the outside. Daniels tries to fight the Kings of Wrestling one-on-two, but it doesn't work. Allison Danger jumps her from behind before Claudio pulls her off and Hero punches her right in the face. We have the return of man-on-woman violence to Ring of Honor.
This is 2003 all over again. Like, just actually, in 2005, there was a spot where Punk just, like, punched Allison Danger in the face. Like, that's, like, a thing with her. And it's not good.
Albert, when we started the show, we noticed that there was a troubling trend in Ring of Honor in the early days where seems like every show there was an instance of some kind of man-on-woman violence. And so we started keeping a track of how many consecutive shows from the very beginning there was. It took us over a year of shows before we found a show that did not have that. So, wow. Again, normally this would be this is like the part of the show that the low point in terms of making you feel like kind of uncomfortable. We're not even, folks, we have just begun our descent. So anyway, fans, they start to throw in a few rolls of toilet paper at Hero. He and Claudia lay out Daniels with the KRS-One finisher. Matt Sydal, Roderick Strong, and Austin Aries run in. Storm and Aries chase the Kings of Wrestling to the back of the building, you know, setting up their match for later tonight. And now we begin the world of shit with our next segment. So Jim Cornette and Shane Hagedorn make their way to the ring. Cornette grabs the mic and tells one fan to save his breath. He'll need it later for his inflatable date. Cornette says he doesn't see too many women in the audience. He doesn't think anyone in Philadelphia gets laid anymore. Cornette says he's come back to this freezing cold, stinking hell. So see, Matt knew, you know, Cornette and Matt simpatico on this one point. Cornette says he came back here because the last time he was here, Homicide insulted him and spit in his face. That gets a pop and a Homicide chant. Cornette says that what was even worse than what Homicide did to him, though, was what the fans in Philly did. They insulted him even worse because they took his side after all of Cornette's sacrifices for Ring of Honor. Cornette calls himself a wrestling god. Then Cornette says he understands Homicide has a little backup tonight. Jim Cornette calls Conan Homicide's butt buddy, although in the same breath he also calls him one of the biggest stars in the history of Lucha Libre. So that was like an odd kind of like, yeah, your butt buddy, you know, well, one of the biggest stars ever.
Which would be like a good pull for Homicide if it was true, you know?
Exactly. Conan's name being mentioned actually got some boos. We can get into why, because we'll get into that history maybe later. I think Cornette, this fan, at this point, he yells at that. I didn't quite make out exactly because the mic quality on this show is awful, but I think, I can't believe I have to say this. He yells at a fan that's flipping off in the crowd. I think this is what he said. What is that finger exactly showing me? Is that your IQ or the number of your white parents?
Yeah, he was like mocking somebody for potentially being mixed race, which is even for like Jim Cornette, that seems like a stretch.
We'll continue. Cornette says Conan and Homicide have bonded over this immigration reform business. They do nothing but smoke wacky tobacco and watch the news together, which, yeah, that sounds like a thing people love to do when they're high, is watch CNN together. You know, you like to blaze one with your homies, see what Anderson Cooper has to say. Anyway, he says they don't feel like their people are being treated fairly. Cornette asks the Yankee – he goes, what about you Yankee fans in Philly? What would happen if everyone in Texas phoned up Mexico City and said they were going to be there next week and that the paperwork you need to become a citizen, it needs to be as easy as possible because most of us aren't going to take the trouble to fill it out anyway. But the ones that do, they won't want to get mixed up, blah, blah, blah.
I can't believe you even followed that. I was just like, what the fuck is he saying? Like – I could not make sense of it.
At this point, some people in the crowd actually start chanting boring as Cornette continues this awful race-baiting promo, which is then shouted down by a louder shut the fuck up chant. And I wrote my notes, no, the first part of the crowd got it right, people. Cornette then continues his race-baiting anti-immigration promo. It stops after another few sentences, thank God.
And by the way, I'd have to ask, because you know, our friend of the show, Shane Hagedorn, he was just standing there listening to this. It's like, I felt so bad for him. It's like, he had to be like, what is going on in my life right now? Like, it had to be crazy to be in the ring for that.
Yeah, it's... And it continues. I mean, after that, Cornette then says, the rules tonight between Carino and Homicide are going to be very special. First off, the special ref will be Shane Hagedorn. The match will be anything goes for Steve Carino, but Homicide has to stick to the rules or he'll get disqualified. And to win the match, Homicide will have to pin Carino for a 10 count. At this point, Homicide's music hits. Audi comes with Julia Smokes, Ricky Reyes, which we haven't seen in a while. And yes, Conan's there. Cornette hides in the corner behind Hagedorn. Conan grabs a mic and calls Cornette a fat, white, redneck cocksucker. And he says something else I didn't even hear, looking motherfucker. That gets some applause from the fans. Cornette says, you can't use that kind of language here in Philadelphia, which I'll admit is a funny line. I'll you know, give credit where credit is due. That's a good line. Cornette calls the Philly fans the realest N-words in the business. Conan says, Kentucky is where the men are men and the sheep are scared, where God took a hellacious dump. I do like the phrase hellacious dump. Again, I'm trying to find any diamond here in what is basically the rusty equivalent of a hellacious dump. Conan points out that unless Cornette is an Indian, he's an immigrant too. Conan says he came to even the odds. They're not going to be stacking the decks against the next future superstar in this business, homicide. Conan says racist pricks like Cornette held back Eddie Guerrero and Rey Mysterio, but not anymore. Conan then says Ricky Reyes hasn't had any matches in Ring of Honor lately, and he wonders if that's a coincidence or by racist design. Cornette says he blames Reyes not getting booked on the fact that he's plain stinking not good enough. Conan at this point asks Cornette to put his life partner's hazelnuts on the line and have Shane Hagedorn take on Reyes. Cornette agrees and says it's going to happen right now, so Shane can then rest up to referee the main event. Hagedorn doesn't want to have the match, but Cornette tells him he's going to wrestle Reyes right now, and he's going to beat him. The crowd immediately starts chanting 30 seconds. Matt, I'll throw it to you first, but I'll just say first off right off the bat, this segment might be one of the very worst things we've ever seen on Through the Years, in my opinion.
Well, so I know you like really hate the show, and I, you know, I'm not far off from you. I think that one of the most noteworthy things about the show is just how consistently bad the mic work is. Like throughout the entire thing, from beginning to end, all it's just inexplicably bad. And some of the people that are doing it are some of the considered some of the best talkers in the history of wrestling. Like, I know that we've been hard on Cornette's promos, but a lot of that is because they felt like repetitive and like tonally inconsistent with what we want from ROH. But like, this was just bad, like just a bad promo that made no sense. And then Conan, I feel like he, you know, I've seen him give good promos before. Like, I feel like he really dropped the ball every time he was given the mic on this particular show. Like, just convoluted stuff like that didn't really get the point across very well. Kind of sometimes even like almost like he wasn't like really like talking into the mic. Like, it was just weird. And I feel like this promo kind of killed the crowd for the rest of the entire show because it was just so weird. I mean, the thing with Cornette talking about you know, all those crazy rules that he was going to impose on the main event. Obviously, the point of that was that it was ridiculous and that it was going to get Cornette fired. But I think it just, like, it felt too at home with what everything else that they've been doing in ROH lately. And this felt like a culmination of just months of bad booking.
Yeah. Albert, before I throw it to you, maybe we should give a little bit of context. So when we talk, if you watch the show and you haven't been with us since the very start and Through the Years, so this is going way back. If you're wondering why Conan might have been booed, it's because Conan was infamous. He had appeared for Ring of Honor one time before this, and that was at Final Battle 2002. Like, he was in a gauntlet match, and he was so negatively received by the crowd there, they edited it off the Final Battle 2002 DVD. They ended up putting it, I think that was one of the matches that made it to the ROH Uncensored DVD, which was basically like a collection of a pre-show matches and segments that were infamous for being so bad they never made DVD. And it was so bad that when Conan was coming booked for this show, ROH wrote something on their like newswire that basically said something to the effect of like, we promise you that the Conan you see in ROH tonight won't be the one you saw in 2002 that got booed out of the build. Like they had to basically promise you, like, look, it won't be like that. And the reason why they're booking Conan is because, you know, Homicide's in TNA at this point, and the LAX angle and tag team actually is kind of gaining some steam and some buzz as like being kind of addressing immigration, and, you know, they're kind of bringing that feud into Ring of Honor. And so they're bringing, even though Hernandez isn't here and Conan's never been booked in Ring of Honor, apart from that, they're like, okay, we'll take this part of this hot act that's connected to one of our top stars, and we'll bring it in for one night. And I would say mixed results at best. What did you think? You know, a company that's, Albert, that's known for wrestling, and you end up seeing like a bunch of in-ring promos on this night.
Yeah, and not just in-ring promos, but some of the most offensive lines that quite frankly felt like all involved should have been arrested, arrested for saying those things in public. Yeah, no, this was difficult. I remember it, you know, at the time seeming weird. Obviously, in 2024 eyes and ears, it seems even worse. And also watching it on the DVD, the mic sounds bad. So it's also just sounds like problematic gibberish. And you just hear you can make out just enough to know that they're saying some pretty reprehensible things. But to say one positive thing about this segment, I do have to give a very special shout out to Conan's jacket that has the logo to every NBA team on it, which not only stylish, but I just love the message that, you know, he's just not only a fan of the league itself, but also a fan of each of the teams, or at least the graphic design of their logos. So I thought that was cool. But yeah, and also, you know, one more thing I noticed on a more lighthearted note, you know, in the beginning when Cornette called a fan something to the effect of, as you mentioned, save your breath, you need it for your inflatable date. They show the guy in the audience and he doesn't look like mad and he's not like booing back. He does look kind of devastated. Like he didn't expect to be made fun of. He looks kind of sad. It's like, I don't know. Like he was just like, oh, I didn't realize this goes both ways. So, you know, that entertained me, but yeah. It was a real mess.
Yeah. So, okay. I had a lot of thoughts. ROH has never like an edgy promotion. It rarely even tried to be, it did not want to be ECW. And I think we've talked about that conscious choice is actually one of the main reasons ROH succeeded. Well, not one of the main reasons, but a reason, like, you know, it tried to be noticeably different from what came before it. And, you know, some of the people came from Ring of Honor, it came from ECW to start this. So, like, wrestling obviously has this huge history of using, like, hot-button divisive issues, a lot of xenophobia, racism, sexism, to sell programs, draw fans, blah, blah, blah. I mean, that's kind of wrestling's bread and butter. But I'm going to say this, like, no matter what you feel about that general concept, even if you are 100% heel, sure, they'll be allowed to do heelish, awful things, you know, it's just like a movie. You know, that's a whole separate debate we could literally do an entire Meet the Press style podcast where we will never do that. I'm going to completely sidestep that debate because I'm going to tell you, even if you think that's perfectly fine, it's so ill, and you know, again, maybe there's an argument for that. It's so ill-fitting for ROH. You can hear it in this crowd. Like, I was actually shocked when some of the fans started chanting shut the fuck up to the fairly loud, boring chant Cornette got during this, because before the fans chanted boring, like, the crowd's uncomfortably quiet during, like, the Cornette race-baiting parts of the promo. Like, it felt like they didn't know how to react. It wasn't like they were really popping huge for some of those lines I'm talking about. Like, they were happy to boo Cornette when he was shitting on Philly. They were happy to boo him when he was shitting on Homicide. But when he starts that weird, prolonged speech about immigration, like, you can tell that isn't an ROH thing. You can feel it in the crowd. Like, that's a Smoky Mountain thing. That's an ECW thing, maybe. That's that edgy kind of, rip from the headlines bullshit. Like, that wasn't what a Ring of Honor fan wanted. And all of that, like, that's only half my problem with this segment. Like, the other half of that, my problem is, like, another one of ROH's big strengths is they found a really nice balance between acknowledging that other wrestling, like, past and present, exists, while making their own product feel like this important, unique world to itself. Like, most indie wrestling companies historically, they act very subservient to any bigger promotion. Like, if some wrestler comes from a bigger promotion, if they're like a mid-carder or that's a complete has-been, that's like long past their heyday, you know, the indie promotion typically rolls out the red carpet and lets them big time the entire promotion, act like, you know, they're a million miles above everyone else in the promotion. And that's fine because, you know, indie wrestling is small potatoes, small scale wrestling. It's part of its charm. But what ROH and like the super indies that came after, like PWG did, I would say, is like, they were able to acknowledge that they were a smaller, like, low-budget wrestling promotion, while also selling they had, like, one of the best promotions in the world in terms of, like, the product they were putting out. And part of that was because, you know, they would frame their small indie nature as, like, a positive. You know, it was, like, the early days of, like, boutique indie wrestling for a generation. And one of the ways they would do that is, like, how they would use – big names, right? Like, they'd be very respectful of them. They'd acknowledge where they came from, but they would not be subservient to them. You know, the vibe was usually like, okay, you were a star elsewhere. You've come to Ring of Honor. You got to prove it in front of our fans. You got to have your working boots on. You know, the first year of Ring of Honor was all about that. You know, like, ICP got rejected. You know, Jeff Hardy got rejected. Conan got rejected. Like, Ring of Honor crowd, sometimes for better, sometimes for worse, if they felt like, you know, not that Ring of Honor fans were not impressed by outside star power and couldn't be charmed by that, but like, they did not just immediately fawn on you just because you were an outside star often. And so what I'm going with all this, I know this is long-winded, but I just want to go, like, the other thing Ring of Honor did was they didn't, like, cede ground to when outside names came in. Like, the Ring of Honor stories superseded other stories. And what makes this segment feel small, so small time, is, like, the whole story now has become the LAX story. Like, it's become a TNA story. Like, instead of this being like Conan's coming as the guest star to help build the Homicide Jim Cornette story, it feels like, oh, like, Conan's bringing the hot LAX story to, you know, ROH for one night, and complete with, you know, Cornette basically cutting the kind of promo he probably would have cut in the LAX feud in TNA. And it just makes ROH feel so small potatoes for me. Like, why is Conan here? Like, why is he going to get the credit for running Jim Cornette off rather than, like, a star in the company? It just, it's, and then on top of that, all of that, the cherry on top is, you want to suggest that Ricky Reyes, a guy who you're not exactly going to feature heavily or prominently after this, like, who's only been sporadically booked before this, like, you want to even mention that, like, oh, has he not been booked recently because of racial profiling? Like, is that something a fan wants to think about on the show? Like, and you want to know how many times Ricky Reyes wrestles in the Gabe era of Ring of Honor after this promo? 2 times. So, like, you better hope that Conan wasn't right, because, man, they don't book him much after this.
So, like, that's an interesting point. I kind of didn't think of any of that, just because, like, yeah, I get what you're saying, where, like, they start bringing up the immigration stuff that they never really – Homicide never really talked about ever in ROH before. But at the same time, I felt like both Cornette and Conan's promos were so marble-mouthed that it was sort of hard to, like, take seriously the substance of them to the point where I cared, like, oh, they're bringing this TNA storyline. It was just sort of like, these two guys are just rambling nonsense, and I don't know what the fuck is going on, and where is ROH? Like, that's sort of how I felt during this.
Yeah, continuing, we go to Ricky Reyes defeating Shane Hagedorn via submission in 3:33 when he made him tap out to the Dragon Sleeper. And this was also not good. Like, Reyes, like, had a gimmick. His most recent gimmick in Ring of Honor was he destroyed the ROH students in, like, these squash matches that were sometimes mildly to moderately entertaining. And the crowd, you know, remembers this to the point where they're doing this thing that they had started doing, I think, near the end of Reyes's little run there, where they start counting to 30 because they, like, they think, you know, that's how long it's gonna take for Reyes to win. And then I've never seen a Reyes versus a student match where the student controls most of the match, and you can hear the crowd, they count to 30 and then they get quiet because they're like, what the fuck is happening? Like, Hagedorn's controlling this, and it's just so fucking bizarre. Like, man, like, am I crazy here? Like, didn't this feel weird?
I just didn't register with me at all. Like, I was just like, I don't like this storyline. This match is going to be short. I don't care what happens in it. Why are they doing this? And it was like a backdrop for, you know, because it's funny because Gabe starts coming in on commentary a few matches in a row, actually, to be like, what's going on with Cornette? What is this, WWE? And I just remember thinking, like, well, just the fact that you're doing, like, a match with commentary talking about something else in the story, that's WWE right there, you know? And it's almost like the commentary was Gabe, like, retroactively apologizing for how bad the booking of the show was. I don't know, or maybe it was the plan all along. I mean, I'll get to the commentary later. But yeah, this match was almost impossible to pay attention to, and nothing was happening anyway. So I just thought this was one of the weirdest book segments in history of ROH, and it doesn't stop here.
Albert, you know, this is one of the weird parts of doing a podcast, which is when we have a guest on and, you know, Matt and I, it's just understood, we comment on everything. And it's always weird when there's like a 3 minute or less nothing segment. And I was like, is it fair to ask our guests, do they have any thoughts on a 3 minute Ricky Reyes Shane Haghorn match? But I'm going to ask you, Albert, it's okay if you don't have any. Do you have any thoughts about this match?
I thought Shane hit a real nice Russian leg sweep during this. Looked good. It made me happy to see Ricky Reyes, because the last time I saw him wrestle was when he was murdered by Matanza on Lucha Underground. So it's nice to see when he was alive and kicking and winning matches. Yeah, and also I will say that the two of you have really helped fill in some blanks for me, because I have not watched every Ring of Honor show up to this point, and I didn't understand the 30-second thing. I didn't know what the context of that was, and I didn't realize Jimmy Bauer was Gabe. I was like, who's this other guy that's talking? But now I know. But yeah, other than that, not much to say, other than when I was watching this week, I was like, oh, these first two matches are short. Obviously, the second one, very short. And then, as the show progressed, I was grateful that they were short.
Albert, but you know, I've gabbed a lot, Matt's gabbed a little, but I'm saving you. I'm giving you, if this is a dinner, I'm giving you the nicest cut, because I'm giving you the one really heartwarming, in my opinion, fun segment of the show. You get first crack at the Four Corner Survival match, where Pele Primo defeats BJ Whitmer, Colt Cabana, and Tank Toland in 11 minutes and 8 seconds, when Pele pinned Toland after a stunner and a roll up. What do you think about this? I'll just tip my hat and say, I desperately needed this match.
Yeah, no, a lot of fun. And, you know, I think you've set me up perfectly, because this is the post-match after Pele Primo wins and goes into the bleachers and is celebrating with fans. I'm visible on camera giving him a big old high five. I'm sure we can put the timestamp in the show notes.
I mean, listen. You already screen grabbed it. Trevor's gonna make it the screen grab for the thumbnail for the show already.
Excellent.
So, yeah. Thank you for that.
Yeah. No, it was a fun match, and I have one thought that came to me while I was watching it this past week, and I think it's very important to share. And I will admit that I wrote it out because I wanted to make sure I phrased it correctly, because I think the substance of it is really important. And I think it's a message that needs to be heard. So here you go. Here's my review of the match. If I'm going to watch a man named BJ performing on a show taking place in the state of Pennsylvania in the fall of 2006, it's not going to be BJ Whitmer. It's going to be BJ Novak on season 3 of The Office.
I just gotta say, Albert, you are like overachieving, because I just want to say, like, to all guests past and present, I used to say every guest has been great. Technically that's still true, but quite frankly, Albert showed up on time, he has notes, he has jokes, like, he's done homework. Like, people need to step this up. Gagne, you're on thin fucking ice right now. I'm just gonna say that right now. Because that was good. Okay, so I will just say, I like this almost as much as I hated the Jim Cornette segment. I feel like one of wrestling's great joys is like the undersized underdog character when it's done well. And man, was Pele good at it for some of his little experiences he had at this point. Like, first off, his bumping. Like, he spends more of this match in the ring than like anyone else by far, and everyone looks like a killer against him. Like, he's so small and like he's like jumping really high for every move, so he's just getting tossed around on so many of these moves that the guys usually do that just look like, oh, you're just used to how those moves look. Like, they look better because he's just getting up for everything. But the bigger thing to me about why Pele's so good is like he is the character work. Like, he isn't just acting, he's reacting to everything that happens in front of him. And if you've listened to the show long enough, you know I love wrestlers who don't just act, but they react, like, who are organically playing off things on the fly. And he's almost Jack Evans-esque in that he's always doing something character-wise. Like, he's always reacting to something. And this is like a story-based match. The story is Pele's the ultimate underdog. no one in the match takes him seriously. Like, Colt's really completely patronizing him. Like, he lets Pele put him in an armbar and he pretends it hurts when it doesn't. But it's the way that Pele plays it. Like, that makes it so good. Like, he never wants to give up. He never takes anything lying down. There's this spot where he can't even Irish whip Colt across the ring. At one point, Colt just sits down as Pele tries just to embarrass him more. And then shortly after, Pele, you know, Colt's trying to Irish whip Pele, and Pele sits down and he goes, how do you like it? Or something to that effect. And Colt just takes him by the arm from a sitting position and like tosses him into the air. And Pele takes a huge bump. And like, that's Pele's character to a T. Like, he's not just the guy that gets beat up, but he's like, he doesn't take it lying down. Like, he's not submissive. He's going to like try and put it back on you and get beat up even more. Like, later on, BJ Whitmer comes in, you know, the second best BJ. Considering what BJ Whitmer has been found guilty of, very far down the BJ depth, let's just say that. Anyway, Whitmer comes in. He wants Pele to tag in Tolan so he can fight him. And even though Pele's been all battered, he still wants to keep fighting. So BJ just shoves him into the corner. Tank tags himself in. And then later at the first chance, Pele blind tags himself back in, and he charges BJ, and he's just yelling, "What's wrong with you, BJ, you son of a bitch?" And he starts throwing slaps at him, and it gets like one of the biggest, like, genuine crowd laughs I think we've heard on Through the Years. It's heartwarming. Like, the crowd is like, just like, this is legitimately funny. And it's just a great character work. And this is one of those matches where if you had never seen this wrestler before, in this case, Pele, like, in the first minute of this match, by the end of the first minute, you know his entire character. And by the end of the match, I think most fans would be cheering a guy that they didn't even know by the, like, And the evidence of that is, like, at the end of this match, when Pele wins, where, like, BJ and Colt are brawling on the outside, they aren't able to get back in time when Pele goes for the pin, you watch the crowd, they literally, like, jump to their feet and give him, like, a standing ovation. Like, I will just say, like, technically this is just a random four-way. It's, like, a nice little bit of fun on an undercard, but you get a few big bumps for Pele, you get some comedy, and you get, like, this really satisfying story told over 11 minutes from beginning to end. But most of all, I would just say it's like the one part of the show, of this entire show, where I just, like, it's a little bit heartwarming. Like, I felt good about watching this match, I would just say. And maybe I'm overpraising, I would say it's like an outright just good as a match, but as a piece of entertainment, it was like the one ray of sun on the show, Matt. And I know I'm talking too much, but I have to give it his credit.
Well, I'm glad you loved it so much. It's definitely the one most positive memory I have of this show. I don't think, like, it hit me quite to the degree it did you, but it was a really nice segment. And, you know, this is the second time they did the surprise underdog win in a multi-man match for Pele Primo, but I think you would probably agree this one was way more impactful than the first one, yeah. Right? I guess because they make him the centerpiece of the match, like you said, to the point where, like, when they have Whitmer and Tolman do, like, a much more basic wrestling match without the comedy, it's sort of like, what the fuck are we doing here? Like, why is this even where's Pele? Like, why are we having a match? He did a great job, to the point where I'm almost a little bit sad that they didn't really do a ton to follow up on it. Like, he was featured a little bit more, but they don't really go as far with him as they could have. The other thing is, like, we kind of get the return of, like, asshole Colt Cabana, where the way he was, like, kind of being mean to Jimmy Jacobs, he's sort of doing that with Pele, just sort of, like, mocking him and things like that, condescending to him by offering his arm and mocking his arm wringer and stuff like that. So I did like the spot where Cabana's like, "I'm going to show you a veteran trick," and then he just does a wrist lock that hurts. Like that's the veteran trick. I thought that was good. The other thing that I note about this is, I think, Tank Tolan's second appearance also, and, you know, the crowd starts chanting, "You're on steroids," and I was sort of thinking, like, Toland, I feel like, had several strikes against him right to start, because he looks so much, other than the height, like a stereotype of, like, a 2006 WWE developmental guy. You know what I mean? Like, you picture a guy that, like, WWE put in developmental, and it's Tank Toland. And I think that's just, like, you know, an ROH fan is liable to not appreciate someone who looks like that so much. But whereas, I guess, in WWE, it's an asset. It's definitely a detriment in ROH. And I think that's probably part of why he didn't. I mean, you know, I think he was fine. Like, he was good in ROH. Yeah. I don't think he ever, but I also don't think he, like, blew anyone away either. And I think he probably would have had to in order to get over just the WWE-ness of himself. The other thing was, did you notice that the crowd chanted, "Where's your toe?" at him, which I think referenced that story that we talked about recently.
Yeah.
Where
Albert, do you know what the "Where's your toe?" chant refers to?
No, and that confused me too.
Okay, so a couple shows ago, Colt Cabana, some of the wrestlers, got into a little car accident between ROH shows as they were driving from one to the other, and for like a brief few hours, like one of Colt's friends like updated apparently the blog for him, or at least that's what Colt claims. It was one of his friends, and was basically like, you know, everyone's banged up, but they're all right, except Colt had to have a toe amputated. And then literal hours later, like Colt had to get on and say, like, that was a joke, he was making it up, all my toes are there. And like, there was literally, I found a PW Torch article where it was like, Colt Cabana has toe amputated. And then the next, like a couple hours later, there's a story that's one line that just says, Cabana's toe not amputated. So that became like a bit of a thing for a few shows of like fans thinking, oh, it's funny. Oh, Colt will have the ref check to make sure he has all his toes.
And that's fine. That's just some wholesome fun that was missing on this show, just like the match itself.
Yeah, this was definitely by far the most wholesome thing on this show. I will give it that.
And Matt, I'll just say, I think you're completely right about the Tank Tolan thing. Like, watching this match, yeah, this is his second match in Ring of Honor. And I think in both his matches, he's been nothing noteworthy, but perfectly fine. And I was thinking kind of similar to what you were thinking, watching, which is like, man, I felt bad for him because I was like, this guy has like the worst combination of physical attributes for 2006 professional wrestling, because he's this ultra jacked dude who's really short. Like, he's barely taller than Pele Primo, whose entire gimmick is that he's small. And so he couldn't make it in WWE because he, you know, especially in 2006, he was always going to feed a guy that short was always going to have a huge, huge barrier to get pushed. And then on the other end, he comes to Ring of Honor, which is like a promotion where more than probably any other at this point, his lack of size is not going to be much of, if any, of a detriment to a push. But he's also in one of the only promotions where the fans are going to see that body and know where he comes from and instantly like be harder markers on him and resent him and be hard to please. Like, they're chanting steroid for him before he does a move in this match, you know, where they're instantly going to just see him as a guy for, you know, whether how much of it is true or not, that is like, oh, you're in wrestling because you took steroids. You know, and I felt bad for him in this match because, yeah, he just – like you – I think you basically said, Matt, like he was going to have to work, like really overachieve to get – to overcome that with fans. And while I don't think he was terrible in these couple of matches, he was not going to be good enough to like overachieve. Like there's a segment in this match where he and BJ basically have like the hockey fight spot where they're throwing a million punches to each other. And it gets about as little of a reaction as you've ever seen like a hockey fight spot in wrestling get. Like, people just did not care about anything he did. So after the match, Pele has another one of his great celebrations where he can't believe he won. He jumps into the referee's arms. He jumps into the crowd to crowd surf, except this time he gets all the way back into the bleachers and the fans freaking drop him. Albert, I better hope you were not one of the fans dropping him.
Albert was all the way up at the top with me because, you know, again, I'm a man of the people and that's where I sit.
Matt, did he get dropped the first time he crowd surfed too? Like, is this like two for two on the drops? I don't remember.
I don't remember either.
Anyway, we'll go to the next segment. Cut to the Briscoes backstage. Jay Briscoe says Davey Richards thinks he got the best of them last week, but don't forget what they did to him in Florida. They're taking on Davey and Delirious tonight. Mark Briscoe says, time to man up, boy. And then maybe an ROH backstage promo first. They do this insane slow-mo just so you can see the newly lost front teeth of Mark Briscoe.
Just adding another layer to how weird this show is. Like, they just do that weird, like, weird slow-mo transition. I don't know.
I didn't realize that's what that was signifying. I just thought it was a surreal Lynchian flourish on the back of
Briscoe's promo. I mean, it was, whether that was what they were signifying or not.
Mark Briscoe would be so good in Twin Peaks. That's all I can think about. Could you imagine Mark Briscoe in Twin Peaks? I guess anything would fit in Twin Peaks, but man, that'd be great. So yeah, Then we bring our next match, which is Nigel McGuinness and Samoa Joe. They defeated Brian Danielson and Jimmy Rave in the Dream Partner tag in 18 minutes, 55 seconds, when McGuinness pinned Rave after the rebound lariat. You would think, is Rave really a dream partner for someone at this point, especially because he was like on a losing streak gimmick? But commentary clears up. They basically say that like Rave kind of inserted himself into this match because he wants to be in a prominent match again and get himself like back in into the swing of things. So this was an A show, technically. You know, it was the Saturday night show in the bigger market, not the B show. That's typically the Friday night show in a smaller market. But man, did this feel like a B show effort. Like, in particular, this match I felt like is something that is becoming very regular for Samoa Joe and Ring of Honor, which is he's in some tag or multi-man, and he spends almost the entire match on the apron. He tags in maybe twice and hits a couple flurries of signature offense, which at this point I'm thinking, I'm starting to realize, like, they're often the same, like, couple flurries of offense, and then he tags back out. Like, he's in shockingly little of a 20-minute match. And part of that's by design, because part of the story of this match is Brian wants to avoid Joe. He does all the classic heel spots where he tags out multiple times early to avoid Joe, like teasing the matchup, but then getting scared away. And Nigel has a very long face in peril sequence in here. But like, even when Joe makes his hot tag with like 3 or 4 minutes to go, it's shockingly short. And then he tags right back out. It's like, dude, Nigel was just in for a lot of this match. And Ryan and Rafe here are meanwhile like very low impact. They don't do a ton of big moves. They do quite a bit of cheating behind the ref's back. And, you know, they do like the missed tag spots where, oh, Nigel tags Joe, but the ref doesn't see it. To the point where at one point, like, Ring of Honor was never like a it was usually like a show respect to the ref's promotion. They actually like get mad at the ref on commentary. Like, at one point, Brian and Rave are taking turns distracting the ref by each saying that they have something in their eye. And Jared Davis is like, this is awful refereeing to fall for this. He goes, who's this ref? And Dave Price goes, Mike Keener. And Jared Davis just goes, I hate Mike Keener. I was like, whoa.
Yeah. It's interesting. Like, that. This is what I was talking about. David showing his personality more. But also, I realized maybe it plays in a little bit in the sense that, like, Keener is going to be in the heel corner in the main event, which is also very weird. Like that they did that. But I guess that was why they felt comfortable saying that. I don't know.
So what I would put about this is like the antics of Rave and Danielson are like this match here where it's mildly amusing, I would put it, but like heavy on the mild. Like, I would consider this match in general as a rating of mild, but I would say it's like a flat good 3 stars, which sadly on the show is pretty decent. Nigel seemed to be like the one of the 4 guys in this match that had his working boots on like a little bit more, but unfortunately this match mostly required him to sell, so he didn't really get to show off a ton. I will say, like, one of the only real highlights of this match for me were the few spots where Danielson keeps preventing Jimmy Rave from getting hit with one of his rival signature moves. Like, at one point, he literally gets in the ring and he pulls Rave out of the way of a Nigel rebound lariat. There's a moment where Nigel goes for the headstand and Brian just grabs him and holds him so Rave can kick him. And then my favorite spot of the match is Joe whips Rave into the ropes. Brian grabs Rave as he hits the ropes so he doesn't bounce back off the ropes, and Joe was going to go for his rebound like power slam, and so Joe still does like the slam to air and just falls to the ground, and then Rave goes to do like a senton on Joe and he falls right into Joe's choke and all that stuff. It's just really neat little twist. It's like, I wish the matches like this. You don't have to have a million big spots in a match like this. I just give me neat little twists on things like that. But I would just say, as it stands, this is a performance for guys who knew they weren't on the top half of the card. They weren't expected to carry the load. And, yeah, perfectly fine, but kind of disappointing given who was involved. Matt, what'd you think?
I guess what I would say about this match is that it was smartly worked, but it was long. It didn't really build to much of anything. And, like, these are some of the best wrestlers in the world. So it's like, this is like, it didn't live up to that caliber at all. Like, it was, I would say it was a house show match with some extremely loud chops mixed in. I don't know if you could find too many Bryan Danielson matches where he seems, I don't want to say he wasn't working, but like, let's be honest, like compared to his usual like effort, like it seems like you wouldn't find too many Bryan Danielson matches where he's working less hard than this, I guess is what I would say. And like, I mean, we know, like, what's going on with him. Like, he's trying to just make it to Final Battle. So he'll have, like, one real match every weekend and then another match where he kind of chills a little bit. I think that's sort of what the trend has been. And he was definitely, again, by his standards, chilling in this match. You know, it's not like he did nothing. But It was just weird to see these guys in such a low impact, just like, and I when I say impact, I mean in terms of moves and also just the impact it had on the viewer match with as little heat as it did. It still had more heat than a lot of matches on the show because of just who was involved. But the other thing was they did again spend a lot of time focused on the commentary where they come in and talk about the Cornette thing. And I just had such a weird reaction to the Cornette thing because Gabe was talking about he comes back to apologize for Cornette's actions and he says that Conan is meeting with ROH management, including Kerry Silken and the matchmakers. And he's like, the rest of ROH management feels like the rules for the main event are an insult to ROH fans and they deserve better than the crap you see on Monday night. And then Cornette's really mad and he's going to do something drastic. And it's just like, I don't know. It's just so convoluted. And like the Conan thing just seems so unnecessary. Like, doesn't it just make sense? Like, if the ROH fans see that, ROH management sees that Cornette is abusing his power, they would just fire him. Like, do they need Conan to be there to explain this to him? Like to them, like they're mad about it. So what's the issue? Like if he doesn't have absolute power and Kerry Silken's like involved, then doesn't it make Kerry Silken seem stupid that he needs Conan to come in and be like, hey, maybe we should, and we'll get to what they end up doing in the promo, which is double stupid. But like, I don't know. It just seemed like way too many unnecessary steps for a pretty obvious outcome.
Albert, what do you think about this? Again, I just keep thinking of 2006 Albert, who gets brought to this Ring of Honor show, and you're seeing like some of the greatest wrestlers of their generation having maybe one of I feel so bad for you retroactively, like one of their most bland kind of just their performances.
Yeah, I would say in 2006, this was, I think, the match on the card I was most excited for, specifically to see Samoa Joe live for the first time, since I was such a fan for his work on TNA. Speaking of Impact, as Matt mentioned just recently. But yeah, I think at the time, I wasn't like blown away, certainly, or anything, but I think I was like satisfied enough. Because I just thought it was cool to see these guys, and in a decent match, and then not really remembering any of that. Going back this past week and watching it, I was again very excited because I was like, "Oh man," obviously excited for Nigel and Joe, and of course Bryan Danielson. And I really haven't seen a ton of Jimmy Rave outside of his time. Again, to mention TNA is part of the rock and rave infection. It's probably the most I saw of him in his career. And I know that, I know certainly Matt has spoken very highly of his work over the years. And I was like, oh, I'm excited to watch this tag team match. This is going to be a treat. And then, yeah, I mean, basically everything that you both just said, like it was not bad, but it definitely was not, I think, what you'd want from these four guys. A lot of stalling, it felt like, a lot of kind of, sort of, kind of old school, but not in like a cool or exciting way, like heel tactics of getting the heat on Nigel. And yeah, it was not action packed. It was action spacious, action uncrowded. I looked up antonyms for packed. It doesn't really work, but I think action spacious. We'll go with that.
I feel like that's gonna be a term that I use for the rest of my life. So thank you.
Again, look up, look, guests, pay attention to Albert. Look, the work he is doing. He is looking up words now for the show. I mean, there's a few notes about this match we'll get to quickly. I'll just say, PW Insider wrote, if you're what, like, I'm going to say, like, there was a few things on this show in the tag matches where I felt like you were seeing more of like the old school spots, like, oh, the ref misses a tag or things like that, or the legal man stuff. And it might be because of this. So the PW Insider wrote at the time, prior to last night's Ring of Honor show, Jim Cornette gave something of a symposium on tag team matches and things performers could do to get the most out of crowd reactions that most of the roster attended. Some of the points Cornette went over were worked into some of the tag team bouts last night. So it's kind of funny because I think
the irony of saying, here's how to get the most crowd reactions to one of like the deadest crowds they've ever worked in front of in Philadelphia.
Yeah, like I was going to say, ironically, like you, I think you can see them working in some of his stuff. And ironically, this is a show that has like three back to back to back, like really mid at best tag team matches, in my opinion. Then a couple of notes about Brian Danielson. The Torch wrote, regarding Brian Danielson's shoulder injury, Gabe Sapolsky says, quote, "It's definitely hurting him every time out. I'm not sure how long he can wrestle with the injury. We're going week to week." And then later he would add that he's said he's offered Danielson a chance to rest and heal up, but Danielson has refused. So I thought that was interesting little context where, like, I mean, maybe Gabe was just doing this to sell Final Battle. Like, oh, is Brian even going to get there? But the word he was putting out at this point was like, we don't even know if Brian's going to make it. And Matt, earlier you talked about, you know, Brian looked like he was kind of taking things off. Another factor might be this is his last match in Ring of Honor before he goes on a tour of Pro Wrestling Noah, which apparently like wrecks him even more. And like he misses the next two Ring of Honor shows because of that tour. So he might even be thinking in the back of my head, like, Christ, I got to go wrestle Kent again soon. I got to get on a plane after this.
Yeah, I mean, that probably is what was going on. Yeah.
But Matt, guys, the most important thing about this match, the most historical thing, Matt, we always talk about Ring of Honor history. I think this is the final show that has a toilet paper shower for Jimmy Rave. I think this is the last time they do it because there's
stuff involving toilet paper after this. Yes. I will say, like, they're turning it into an angle, which, you know, you'll talk about in the post-match promo, and you know it's not done after this. I would say, and I think it's good because it had absolutely run its course.
Yeah. After the match,
toilet paper sounds very ominous.
Well, it was already post Halloween, Albert, so you don't have to worry about it.
After the match, someone in fact throws a roll of toilet paper at Rave, and he jumps into the crowd to try and get to the fan, but he's kept away. He's dragged to the near the back by security. Nigel sees this is going on. He gets on the mic to say, "Shit happens." He tells the security, "You know, get Rave to the back." Nigel asks Rave to act professional. He says, "You know, Rave, you're the laughingstock of the company. No one takes you seriously." He goes, "You know, deal with this like professionals. Go to the back. No one needs to get sued here. You know, don't attack the fan." And we have our new entry in the world of Ring of Honor weird, slightly shooty ankles, where it's like I'm pretty sure that was a crowd plant, and we're supposed to believe
it was absolutely a crowd plant. Yes.
It was definitely not you or Albert. But, like, again, we're supposed to believe that, you know, Rayleigh's gotten so much toilet paper thrown at him, he's, like, legit freaked out, you know, and gone nuts. And now Nigel's, like, legit admonishing him in front of the crowd. Like, it's just you know, this belongs in the pantheon of, like, the ROH riots and the trying to work the first Roderick Strong-Brian Danielson match at the finish was a shoot hole thing. You know, it's not on that level of those, but it does have a little of that vibe where you're supposed to think, oh, did he really get mad? Is Nigel shooting here? But before the next match, Jim Cornette comes out. Oh, good Lord. He comes out to the ring with the Briscoes. Jim grabs the mic and he screams his head off. He says he's never been so insulted in his entire life. Shane Hagedorn's injured after that match with Reyes. He can't even referee the main event tonight. So since Jim can't get the referee he wants for the match tonight, the main event's just canceled. Cornette says Homicide is also canceled.
This is a really important moment in really the history of the world, Trevor. Jim Cornette invents cancel culture right
exactly.
Here.
Ironically, the one person that gets canceled is Homicide, apparently.
Yeah, he cancels Homicide. Everybody, listen to me. This show invents cancel culture. Everything that's happened in the world in the past 18 years all goes back to this one moment in this weird promo by Jim Cornette. You don't understand if you go back and go back to in time to stop Jim Cornette from using that line. Everything is different. Is it better? Is it worse? I don't know, but it's different. People.
You were so earnest on that last line.
It's important to know.
You almost sound like Mark Maron, like on an episode of WTF going when he's going through something like, it's different. Like, Yeah, Court says Homicide is canceled. He's fired. Jim says as long as he's commissioner, Homicide will never step foot in a Ring of Honor ring again. Now stick that up your ass. We then get a very mild bullshit chant. So like it shows you that even when they're trying to do this heat angle, the crowd's just like, fuck, what is this? And then Homicide, Conan, Julius Smokes, Ricky Reyes come out. Conan gets on that shitty second microphone that barely works, so you can barely understand what he's saying. Conan says he was meeting with ROH's owner and matchmaker, and since ROH is about giving the people what they want, the people are going to have to make a decision. He asks if the fans want Cornette to stay. The fans boo. He asks if they want Homicide to stay. The crowd cheers a lot louder than they booed Cornette. Homicide says, in the words of Satan, you're fired. And, like, again, we're talking about, like, seeing into the future. Like, Homicide is right about calling Vince McMahon Satan. Cornette freaks out, says he can't be fired. Who's going to make him leave? Security and ROH students come to the ring as the crowd chants, na 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 na, hey, 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 goodbye. Eventually, Cornette gets dragged from the ring as he screams, you can't do this to me, I'm a star. And Jay Briscoe, who's in the ring for the match coming up, leans to the camera and goes, what the hell is going on? How the hell do they fire the commissioner? And then Delirious' theme hits. And that is the end of Jim Cornette in this run of Ring of Honor. And, this was an awful end to end a storyline that had quickly become awful. In a way, it's great because it ends a storyline that is awful. But Matt, what a bizarre! I know you had thoughts earlier, like you were saying, like about the way this was going to happen. What a bizarre way to end this, having basically after all Cornette did, like still leaving it up to the based on boos and cheers, we're going to decide if this racist man drunk on power is going to be fired right now.
Right, and like. Run by Conan, who can I'm sure it's the microphone, but I do think he does a bad job of like articulating what like is going on here. He just kind of like rambles through it. He rushes through it. He calls Conan a homophobic slur, which is not very great babyface move. And like I don't know, this is an important moment in this angle, right? And he's just like, yeah, so cheer boo, like whatever, you know. He doesn't seem to care that much. It's like, why do they leave this up to him? And like, then Homicide says something weird, right? The Satan thing. Like, you're right. Like, it makes sense and it's apt for Vince McMahon, but it's a pretty random way to do it. I don't know. It just feels like they did a terrible job executing this. Like, it was so bad. I can't believe how bad the promos on the show are. And again, it doesn't end here either, but like, this is supposed to be a huge moment and it's just terrible. And the crowd, like, I guess they mostly cooperate, but you could tell that they're really just like kind of confused and like, what is this show that we're watching? Every single like segment had some sort of weird promo after it, including the Rave Nigel thing. Like, that was weird too. It's just like, I don't know, the most non-ROH show I've ever seen.
Yeah, Albert, I mean, what did you think about this, seeing this live? Like, what a weird thing to be a witness of.
Yeah, and I think at the time I didn't necessarily know how Out of the Ordinary was, although I'm sure Matt did a good job of filling me in. But yeah, it is bizarre. It's not good. And, you know, I was thinking, I was at a independent wrestling show in the year 2016, so exactly a decade after this, and someone used a homophobic slur, and it was like time stopped, right? Like, everyone was shocked to hear it. I still remember like the face me and my friend made at each other when that happened, and you know, there was an apology for it after. And I think that same slur was on this show a decade earlier between 5 and 10 times. So I guess there is some consolation of society progressing in that time.
I'm sure Albert, like the locational difference probably also contributed, right? Like, some places are more tolerant of this horrible stuff than others. And I think probably, yeah. So Southern California is probably one of the places that's more progressive than others.
I think all of that's relevant, but yeah, really bizarre stuff. Not great. I was excited to see the Briscoes, who I had never seen wrestle live before. So again, to put some sort of positive spin on it, I was excited to see them.
Matt, I'm offended. You need to apologize to our Philadelphia listeners for even suggesting that Philadelphia wrestling fans are not as like progressive as California wrestling fans.
I've said, and people who've listened to the show have heard me say the same thing about New York wrestling fans, that California, like the California fans, are definitely more progressive as a whole.
So I thought, Albert, that was a great point. Like, I feel like, you know, wrestling for most of its history when someone did something racist or xenophobic, you know, like there's lots of reasons why, but like it would just turn into heat that was directly on the wrestler, not on like the promotion or the people behind the characters. And, you know, nowadays, yeah, I think in most promotions, it's largely changed where fans do not want that. And rather than going, oh, this is a heel doing something heelish, I should boo them, they just go, man, this is a bummer. Man, I feel kind of gross that you're acting this way, blah, blah, blah. I feel like this was like the middle ground, like the middle of the transition. And you can tell like Conan and Cornette, you know, like they're thinking, throwing all the slurs, like the slurs never get a good reaction on the show. Like you can tell like that's the stuff the crowds are reacting to the least. It almost reminded me of like years and years later when Gabe was booking, you know, another promotion, Evolve, and they had Joey Styles for a short little bit. And he famously like made some Donald Trump grab him by the pussy jokes, and you know, Gabe dropped him for that. And I think Gabe's reasoning was like, it's not even a politics thing. It's just like, it's divisive and it bums out the crowd, like in the modern crowds. Like they're here to have a good time and that just bums them out. And you can hear that here in 2006. Like you can hear, I think, the crowd being just like, they're not popping for that. It's a bummer that they keep making so much of this about like race and homophobia and all this shit. Even in Philly. And and Matt, to your point, like it's bizarre that, again, I realize LAX was a hot feud, but it's bizarre that they have not just one, the end of Cornette by crowd opinion poll, and two, Conan being like the engineer that makes it all happen when he's never going to be back in Ring of Honor after this. The one time he was ever there, he was hated. And like, why not give a wrestler in the company why not have a match where it's like, book a match where Homicide wrestles somebody, and you know, if Homicide wins, Cornette is fired. You know, give him the credit. Why give Conan like that victory? You know, it's bizarre. And it's also weird where like this feud, you know, this was supposed to be the thing that carried them to Final Battle, which is still six shows away. And it's ending here like with such a wet, like just of a finish. And, you know, like Cornette does not come back in like he does come back in the Sinclair era. But like this is it for him, and it's just like in the middle of a show, like Homicide never really gets to lay him out or do anything. He's almost kind of subservient, like he's just in the background as Conan does his thing. It's just such a weird feeling, so WWE feeling. Like I will give Ring of Honor credit. They did kind of build to it over the last two or three shows where they kept progressively pushing more and more in commentary that like Cornette's really starting to lose his mind and abusing his power more and more. And they did, like you were saying earlier, Matt, try and frame it as like, this is an example of what, you know, we're not like WWC. When Cornette tries to be like the crazy overbearing heel commissioner, we get rid of him. But it just, it's anticlimactic. It's shitty. It's awkward. It's poorly executed in the ring. It's one of the worst things Ring of Honor's ever done.
But listen, like this whole Cornette Homicide angle has just been a complete bust from the from the beginning. I mean, that first angle in Philly with the after Cage of Death got over to a point. Although I think with like the whipping and stuff, I think they already took it in a weird direction right off the bat. Then Cornette was gone for like a month and a half. Then he came back, did a bad promo, mostly did crappy promos every time out between now and then. I feel like Homicide lost heat by the minute that angle happened. I just feel like this was ill-conceived from the start. And, you know, I don't necessarily blame Gabe in the sense of like, okay, sometimes things don't work out and you book something that doesn't work, but like, boy, did this not work. And I think it not only hurt the heat of Homicide, it hurt the heat on the Briscoes. I think it ruined what could have been a hot main event on this show between Carino and Homicide, because all their other matches had a lot of intensity. And this one, I think, had this like weird Cornette pall over it, where even Carino was doing the most crass, like 90s style promos and stuff. Like, and when it got away from sort of like the quirky charm of his ROH character in previous years, I just think that like the vibe that Cornette brought once he turned heel, and even before that, honestly, was just so non conducive to what ROH fans would have been interested in 2006. And it's just interesting in the end, just to think about what a flop this all was. I can't think of another ROH angle or direction that failed so much. And like, if once you get to Final Battle, it's kind of all forgotten. You know, Homicide gets the big moment in his hometown, but like, while this was going on, it just did not work.
Yeah, and I want to talk a little bit about Cornette and Omega as a whole, since this is the end of his run on Through the Years, at least. But first, I want to point something out too, which is there are some things, you know, occasionally we watch and maybe we dislike it more retroactively or like it more retroactively. This was not something like we're going, oh, you know, in 2024 eyes it's bad. But like, one, the crowd didn't like it. It was not well received anywhere. Like, I'll go to the Observer. This is how it was reported about at the time. Dave Meltzer would write, "To explain Cornette's absence due to resting up for the next several weeks or months," and I'll point out we talked about this a few shows ago, where like Cornette was apparently having like issues with his voice or something, which seemed to have vanished on this show. His voice sounded fine, but anyway, he was going to take time off and devote just time to TNA. So anyway, Dave writes, "To explain his absence due to resting up for the next several weeks or even months, aside from two pay-per-view weekends with TNA, Ring of Honor did an angle on November 4th in Philadelphia where Jim Cornette was fired. There were mic problems, and both segments and the angle didn't get over the way it was hoped. The other problem is a lot of ROH fans hate TNA unless it involves people who are in ROH first, like Joe, Homicide, and Christopher Daniels. So Cornette wasn't over anywhere near as a babyface that was expected. The idea sounded good, with LAX hot and Homicide so over, but the ROH fans see their Homicide as a different person than the LAX TNA Homicide. The idea they were going with is that Cornette doing those one-sided stipulations and canceling the match was supposed to indicate that he had gone insane, but that didn't get across. In hindsight, even with the mic problems, it was chalked up to them attempting a concept that the audience didn't want to see. The feeling was, instead of thinking Cornette had gone insane from the pressure of the Homicide feud, they just saw him as doing the heel commissioner role, and the one-sided vindictive actions were stuff that people had seen on Raw, and it isn't what they wanted. Anyway, it didn't work. This was done because Cornette won't be back for several months." So that's interesting that they thought at this point they were like, "Oh, well, Cornette's going to come back." Well, he doesn't come back in this run. This is it for him. But
yeah, but I think all this is underselling like the problem, Trevor. Like, it's not just that. Like, it ruined everything. Like, ruined is too strong. It put a pall over everything for months. Watch ROH shows from January until June of 2006, or let's say till Cage of Death. Then watch ROH shows after that and compare the relative crowd noise during those shows, especially on the shows since Glory by Honor 5. Compare the crowd noise to literally everything on those shows. It's consistently the least heat any series of ROH shows has ever gotten in the entire time that ROH has existed, in terms of consecutive shows with quiet crowds, with things that don't seem to be getting over. Like, I don't know if it's all because of this Cornette Homicide feud, but it seems like a big culprit, especially when we see how it killed the crowd on this night.
So I swear we'll get back to the show and poor Albert, but like, I just want to touch on quickly, like, now that Cornette's run is done, like, Matt, we've been through the whole thing. I think you've given a lot of your thoughts. I'll just say, like, I think I've said this recently, but just to sum up again, you know, because this is the last Cornette show in for Through the Years, like, about his entire run, I'll just say, like, what I always say, which is, like, Jim Cornette, however I feel about things he's said and done outside the ring, however I feel about the ROH run, like, he's one of the greatest managers of all time. He's a great promo. But I feel like doing this podcast, we've revisited so many little snippets, like, particularly from The Observer, that really hyped how, like, Cornette and ROH is doing some of the best promos in wrestling. And I feel like that's a thought you can either only have if you drop in only really occasionally and selectively to ROH during this period, or you're just, like, this incredible Cornette super fan. Like,
no, it could also be just, like, that you come in with preconceived notions, and it's just, yeah, like, you know, he gets almost, like, more of a pass, or like is graded on a curve because he comes with the reputation preceding him. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, he did have some solid promos in ROH outside of his heel run, but I always go back to I feel like he felt like just a little ill-fitting for ROH. Like, you know, ROH always had this hip, modern promotional energy, and Cornette never has it. He's like the throwback, it used to be better energy even back then. And I just never bought him. Like, the way I would put it is, you know, wrestlers are workers. They lie all the time. And when wrestlers come to a promotion like this, it's their job to put it over whether they believe it or not. But I have no idea, like, when Mick Foley came to Ring of Honor and he put over, like, how much he liked the promotion, whether he meant it or not. I know he showed up for, like, a Long Island show when he wasn't even booked just for free, because I think multiple shows for free just because he felt like it. But when he said, like, oh, I really like this company, I like being here, I believed it. You know, I have no idea if James Gibson, like, when he got emotional near the end of his ROH run and talked about how, like, this short run means so much to me, I have no idea if he really believed all of that or not. I believed it. When Cornette, like, put over Ring of Honor, like, I'm sure there's elements of it he really liked, people he really respected in it, but I never bought him as, like, the face of the company who knows the ins and outs of what the fans want, of what who loves every part of Ring of Honor, who has the knowledge. And as the commissioner, you're kind of that's what you kind of have to sell, right? Like, I always go back to that promo he did during the ROH-CZW feud, that Death Before Dishonor, where he's, like, on the mic with John Zandig, not necessarily a guy.
At the 100th show, you mean?
Yeah, the 100th show, I mean. Yeah, thanks for correcting. That's right. Like, and you know, John Zandig, not known for being, like, the master wordsmith, and, like, just talking about, like, indie wrestling in the scene, and Zandig is scoring points on him. Because, like, he's
Cornette,
not –
because Cornette wasn't up on what he was talking about, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so, like, I feel like Cornette is just – my takeaway is, like – it's just like he did a few good things, and I think he did try and promote the company. But I think people that just look back on it and jump in, like, you're not seeing the whole picture. He did not fit in completely. And the fans did love him, like, in some markets. Some of those shows we've watched, he got big reactions when he came in before this heel run.
I mean, he earned his legend status. It's not like he was undeserving of that respect. Yeah.
But for me, I would just say, like, I never completely bought him in this role. You know, I could never completely let go. And maybe that's some of my biases from, like, knowing his tastes and what he liked before this and what he would do after this, especially on his next run in Ring of Honor, how he would rub up against some wrestlers in the company. Like, I don't know. There's just something about it that was never completely a comfortable fit for me. I don't know if you have any other thoughts, but
no, I mean, we talked about it during his promo. Yeah. It was promos during the – early in the CZW feud, where he didn't seem to even understand what CZW was or who the people he was talking about were. So it's, I mean, that says it all right there.
Okay, so Albert, we've left you out for too long. So executive decision. You said you were excited to see the Briscoes. The next match was the Briscoes, Jay and Mark, defeating Davey Richards and Delirious in 1602 when Jay pinned Delirious after Spike Jay Jailer. So now you're going to get to talk about this match first. You're going to get to talk about the match where there was a literal announcement multiple times during the match that a car needed to be moved. Over Bobby Cruz has to get on the mic and tell the entire building mid-match, could someone please – you can see, like, this was at the National Guard Armory. You could see someone, like, in army fatigues during this match walk up to Bobby Cruz and be like, you got to tell someone to move their car.
Yeah, I think similar to the previous tag match, you know, I was excited to see it live. I was excited to rewatch it. And yeah, not super memorable, but also nothing, you know, bad about it either. It was also cool to see, again, Davey Richards kind of at this early form in his career. He's someone who, you know, I certainly saw a lot over the years in PWG and elsewhere. And I had not obviously seen him in this form in 18 years. And, you know, his offense still looked really good. Loved that, like, handspring into the kick and some other stuff he did. But, yeah, overall, you know, solid, but nothing super memorable. Also, you know, shout out to referee Todd Sinclair for doing a great job of keeping track of who the legal man is. If Jim Ross had been on commentary in this match in the year 2019 to 2020, he would probably be very happy to see it.
Matt, what do you think about this? And let's just confirm that this was not your car.
It was, I mean, I didn't move my car, and I don't think that was my license plate number. So, and it was still there when I left. So I think that it was not my car. Yeah. I think the worst thing you could say about the match is that probably the most memorable part of it was the fact that they kept announcing for the move the car, and to the point where Delirious actually yelled at one point, "Move your car, goddammit!" because he was annoyed that it was getting interrupted. I mean, here's the thing. I think, unlike in the last match, I didn't think these guys were really, like, holding back. you know, but like, I think there were a lot of things working against them. First of all, the weird angle right beforehand, I think, killed the crowd. And I do think this crowd was deader than most crowds would have been. And I think in front of another crowd, this match would have seemed a bit better than it was. Then you had the car thing. So despite the fact that I think this match had good athleticism, I think just like the weird vibe was off. The flow of the match was off. It seemed sloppier than it was. I just think it didn't click. Mark in particular, as always, we always talk about how hard the Briscoes work. He was just working so hard during this match. The crowd just wasn't giving him much. But between getting a one count off a suplex, and it's funny because, you know, nowadays when someone kicks out of a suplex at one, people go crazy, right? Like, that's a big spot in a match. And in this match, it was just, okay, I got kicked out of one, who cares? And, he finally gets a pop, Mark does, off of that cool springboard split-legged corkscrew senton flip thing that he did on Delirious, who was laying over Jay's knee. And I think on a hotter show in a hotter crowd, that move would have set the crowd abuzz for like minutes after. And here it was just forgotten pretty quickly. But yeah, after that, they do a lot of their normal stuff. Davey does a big dive to the floor on Mark as Delirious blind tags him and covers Jay for two. And when he dives, he yells, "Motherfucker!" Which, again, would probably get the crowd going on other shows, and it just doesn't really here. And like Albert said, there's a lot of situations where somebody covered somebody and they weren't the legal man, so they didn't count the pinfall. But yeah, in general, I think that these guys did work hard, and I think that it was mostly just circumstance really working against them, so the match really wasn't that good.
Yeah, I thought this match was weird. I thought this was another match with, I hate to keep saying it, like B-show energy, but maybe we should start calling it like ROH Winter of 2006 show energy, but that's not as catchy. Like, the match started slow. You got some Delirious comedy with him tagging immediately multiple times. Some mat work that is fine. All stuff that is acceptable if the match, like, really picks up later. Like, but it doesn't pick up that much. Like, Delirious is the face in peril. And even with the Briscoes, who's like one of the great, like, cool offense teams of their generation, when they're in control, for just a lot of the middle of the match, it just feels a little by the numbers, even though like the effort is somewhat there. Like, it's a little off in the sense that the crowd's so quiet. This is one of the multiple matches on the show where the crowd's so quiet, you can hear a lot of spots being called in this match. And then after a while, there's a point where the Briscoes actually kind of start hitting their rhythm, where they're just popping up some of their cool signature stuff, like bam, bam, bam. And you've seen it a million times before, but there's something about like that relentless pace where I was like, oh, this match is starting to get into like a little bit of a comfortable groove, like not an amazing groove, but like a familiar, enjoyable one. And then Delirious tags back out, and the match is supposed to pick up. And you do get some bigger stuff, but I feel like the match kind of falls back out of the groove. And then the end, which you guys touched on, is so weird, where, you know, Davey Richards gets pinned. The ref, like, tells the Briscoes, like, Davey's not the legal man. So seconds later, Davey tries to pin one of the Briscoes, and the ref just tells, like, Davey, like, I just said, like, you're not the legal man, so your pin doesn't count either. And then what happens next is, like, the Briscoes go outside. They grab Delirious, who had just been selling out there for a bit. They throw him in the ring. They hit him with the spike J-Jiller immediately and win with, like, no real build. It was like almost like they were like, oh, like, we thought we were going to beat Davey, but I guess you're not going to count that, so let's grab Delirious. I mean, I'm sure that wasn't really the plan, but it felt that way. It was just a really bizarre, and like, it felt like something got screwed up, even though I have no idea if it did or didn't. And I would just say, just a level of weirdness, things never quite clicked or gelled. Like you said, Matt, the crowd being killed by the angles tonight, I would give it like a 2.5-star average. And the other notable thing, other than the car thing, was, Matt, this is not even the first time we've seen this. It happened again. Jay Briscoe loses his gum mid-match and picks it back off the canvas. Like, this man needs better gum. Him and Mark both need to watch their gum, apparently, because in different respects, but it just kept happening. So
have you ever, and we've talked about this before, but have you ever heard an explanation from wrestlers about why some wrestlers chew gum during a wrestling match?
I never have.
It just seems like a bad idea and a potential choking hazard. That's how I think of it.
I think we theorized once that maybe it was just like, I knew I used to like, I would chew gum when I had to do math tests at school because I thought it helped me concentrate. But yeah, I kind of like, it's crazy. We've never heard a story of like someone choking on gum, but I guess most people don't chew big enough gum to like have be a choking as you just accidentally swallow. It would be hilarious if there was a wrestler whose gimmick was like they were eating like five pieces of Hubba Bubba and just trying to keep that in their mouth the entire match. That's the gimmick. Again, bring back the heartwarming gimmicks to wrestling. But yeah,
I guess my worry about choking is in line with my worry about Albert getting cold.
Exactly. Matt, you care for like your heart, you worry for the rest of us. But it's now intermission. We join Lacey backstage, who says tonight she's just sitting back, enjoying the show. And then all of a sudden, Colt Cabana comes out for his match, ruined the night for Lacey. Lacey says the sight of Colt disgusts her, and now she's going to use all her money to take Colt out. Daisy Hayes walks in and interrupts. She's angry that Lacey slapped her last night, called her a loser. She wants to know why. Lacey says, oh, I just call it like I see it. And so Daisy challenges her to a match for the future, and Lacey sarcastically just says, anytime, and walks away from her, and that's the entire segment. So kind of a nothing segment, but it is setting up a future match.
Lacey, who I learned from last week's episode of this podcast, is apparently the richest person in wrestling.
Yeah, they just start really hyping it up. Like Matt and I were talking about that on that episode, and I think it continues here. Like, because Colt references later, like with all your money, Lacey. Like they had never really pushed the idea that like Lacey is rich until the last couple of shows, and now they're leaning into it.
That was the second most shocking thing I learned from the previous episode of this podcast. Number one, of course, was the collective dismissal of Sloppy Joe's.
Yes, there are all sorts of Matt and Trevor secrets you can hear listening to the archives, all sorts of revelations that, quite frankly, I don't even remember.
Things that we don't remember about ourselves, basically.
There are a lot of times on this show where people will like – well, not a lot of times, but occasionally on like people will tweet to me like, oh, I just heard this show. Like what about, you know, remember the dingo? And I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like I don't remember. And sometimes they'll be like –
remember the
dingo?
Is that actually something someone said?
No, okay. It isn't. But I just tried to think of like – it'll be things that seem that weird to me. Like remember this? I'll be like, what? Like no, I do not remember this. But
that's why you got to consult the wiki.
The through the years non-existent wiki. That brings us to the Ring of Honor World Tag Team title match. The Kings of Wrestling, Chris Cyril, Claudio Castagnoli, successfully defend the titles when they defeat Austin Aries and Roderick Strong by disqualification. 16 minutes, 55 seconds, when Aries got caught using Claudio's Halliburton briefcase. Before the match, Hero has Bobby Cruz announce that the Kings of Wrestling are very sorry, but the CZW tag team titles are not on the line tonight, which I thought was a nice, cute little troll. Matt, this is a rematch of the tag title change at Glory Bonner Night 2. And yeah, we weren't huge fans of that match. We thought it was a little bit underwhelming. What'd you think about this? The rematch, you know, and not, we'll see one more of these coming up. So what'd you think about this one?
Okay, so I thought this was the best of the three tag team matches we had on the show by a pretty good margin. I don't think it was great or anything, but I think they kept moving at a good, pretty good clip. I think the heat was better than a lot of the things on the show, even though it wasn't particularly good. It was funny, given all of the crass promos and chants on the show, that there was a point where the crowd chanted "Kings of Nothing" at the Kings of Wrestling, and I was like, now that's wholesome for a 2006 Philly indie crowd. On this show in particular, chanting "Kings of Nothing" just felt like innocent enough to kind of cleanse my soul. You know what I mean? But I like that it started fast. You know, I like that they kept things moving. I think they did build to a hot finish, like to the part where Aries kicked out after Claudio hit him in the ribs while he was on the top rope. That actually got like a pop that was big enough to seem like it was on a normal show, you know, like with a normal crowd, because it got a really big pop and you wouldn't expect that on anything from this show. I mean, the big negative on this match is, like, I think in any ROH show, a DQ finish because the babyface decided to beat up the heels with a weapon instead of trying to win kind of doesn't really land in ROH. But on this show in particular, with all the weird promos and all the bullshit, this is just the last moment that you need another WWE-esque finish or moment. And I think that really took the match down a lot for me. But honestly, overall, I liked the match. Like, I liked Strong and Aries' effort. I liked, you know, Hiro's shenanigans, which he always does, and I think his verbalness when he's wrestling, I enjoyed all that. I thought the finish really sucked, and I think it sucked even more than normal because of the show it was on.
Yeah, I like this match, I think, less than you. I did like the hot start like you did, where Aries and Strong jumped the heels after they refused to after the heels refused to shake hands, and they really take it to them. But it kind of quickly settled down after that into kind of like a similar structure to their first match, where you get this long period where the faces dominate and then a long period where the faces dominate. And normally I find that kind of refreshing in this era of wrestling, because so many matches are your move, my move the whole way. But there's something about that structure and these matches these guys have been having with each other that feels kind of flat. Like, it doesn't feel like it's building heat. Like, each section feels oddly disconnected from the other. It almost feels like one team takes control and basically tells the other team, okay, like, it's your turn to drive. Like, the vibe I got watching this, it was almost like when you were a kid and your parents like took you shopping, and first you had to go to like a boring store like Home Depot or something that you didn't want to go to, and so you're pouting and kind of checked out, and they're having a great time because they love housewares. And then afterwards, like, as promised, you get taken to Toys R Us, and now it completely flips and you're having a great time and they're mentally checked out. It kind of felt that way. Like, when each team took control, it was like the energy on one side of the match goes up, the energy on the other side of the match kind of goes down. I feel like we've rewatched two matches between these two teams, and I can't recall many times where I've seen two tag teams that are this talented, this good, have so little chemistry with each other. Like, it gets kind of sloppy as the match picks up late. Like, there's a lot of this awkwardness, like just little physical awkwardness spots, including, like, there's a couple moves late where Roddy is clearly having trouble doing things to a guy like as tall and lanky as Claudio, and there's just these weird little hitches. I did love the near fall, like you loved, like, late, where Claudio hits Aries with the briefcase, which is the same thing he did to win the tag belts, and Aries kicks out. Like, that's one of those things where, like you were saying, you know, you feel like, okay, this crowd's just dead for the night. And then for one moment, like, they wake up, you're like, oh, you're still capable of, like, being that loud. Like, you still care. So, but oftentimes, again, this crowd's kind of dead silent. And then the actual finish, like you said, like, not a great finish on this night. I'm not opposed to these kind of cheap finishes where there's a ref bump, Claude and Hiro try and use the briefcase, Aries grabs it and uses it, the ref catches them, and it's a TV kind of TV promotion style, like cheap DQ. It's interesting where I feel like a lot of people, like 20 years ago, like, no, a lot of people, what am I trying to say? A lot of people are of the opinion that, like, oh, if I see a great match and it has a cheap ending, it ruins the match for me, and so I hate the finish. Where I'm almost the opposite, where it's like, if I see a great match and there's, like, a cheap ending like this, I'll say, well, at least I got to see most of a great match. Where, like, if I see a match where I'm kind of like, meh, this is a bad night, this is kind of only an average match, and then the finish is bad, like, I hate the finish and the match even more. I'm like, because there's nothing to save it. And I thought this was just like a compounding bummer to me. Overall, like, I thought this match was average, maybe slightly above average because of the briefcase near fall. But I feel like these guys don't have a ton of chemistry against each other.
Yeah, I think I liked the match more than you, but
you definitely did.
But yeah, I had not like great or anything, but I think solid enough before the finish.
Albert, what'd you think?
Yeah, I'm closer to Matt on this one. I mostly enjoyed it, not, you know, in a huge way, but I think, you know, definitely coming off to similarly kind of unmemorable tag matches, this was definitely my favorite of the three. And I do kind of think the ending bummed me out, especially seeing it in today, you know, because I did watch it literally today before we recorded. It feels like you know, that kind of DQ ending, which is, I think, a way that wrestling has progressed in a good way. Like, you know, you don't see those as much anymore. I certainly don't think you would see them in, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but in something like a, you know, major indie like this. So yeah, it just left me a little cold, but you know, I thought a lot of the work was good. I really like all four of these wrestlers. But yeah, it was certainly, you know, much like the Danielson and Nigel and Joe and Jimmy Rafe match. If you took these four guys and you said, oh, they're having a tag match with each other at an ROH show in 2006. And, you know, I sat down licking my lips, excited to see what this was, even though I had experienced it in person 17 and a half years ago. And then, yeah, this isn't exactly what you would hope for that.
Yeah, and after the match, an infuriated Aries keeps using the briefcase. He puts it against Claudio's head and punts the briefcase into his head. He goes to brainbuster Claudio onto it, but then Chris Hero stops him. Two teams spill to the floor, then to the crowd, where Aries and Hero bash each other right in the head with the briefcase, which is, you get ready to see a lot more unprotected headshots tonight. Hero throws Aries into the guardrail section sign. Aries crotches Hero with the sign. And honestly, I thought this minute-long brawl was more entertaining than the match. I thought, hey, this is pretty good, actually. And that brings us to the semi-main event, another kind of notable match. Kenta defeated Matt Sydal, scored to the ring by Christopher Daniels, via pinfall in 16 minutes, 45 seconds after he hit the go to sleep. This was the final match of Kenta's, like, 2006 Ring of Honor. I guess you wouldn't call it an excursion because he kept working Noah for the most part, but his kind of, like, mini semi-regular run in 2006. I've talked before about how Kenta's a guy I can love, but also sometimes I can see what his detractors saw. It's another one of those matches where I see a little bit of the latter in this match. Like, this is a match that kind of falls into that hole that Kenta matches could sometimes fall into, where it's two guys doing all their signature stuff back and forth, nothing else. There's no transitions. There's no interaction in terms of personality. Like, the parts do not become larger than the whole. If this match was a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, like, the peanut butter and jelly do not become one. The layers sit very distinctly on top of each other. Do not blend. This is not a Goobers match. But what I will say is these two have some pretty good peanut butter and jelly. Like, they have, of all the people on the roster, these are probably two of the most fun sets of offense on the roster. Like, Kenta's kicks just don't stop being absolutely batshit insane to me. Like, there's a moment in this match where Kenta's just hitting Sydal over and over with kicks to the upper chest, where it's coming, like, right under his chin. And I'm thinking, like, you either have amazing, like, body control or a willful disregard for the idea that you might be endangering your opponent. And it's probably a combination of both, especially because, like, I was browsing the Voices of Wrestling Discord this week, and there I watch everything, but I was overseeing, like, seeing some people. I was not participating, but I saw a conversation, so I want to give them credit for it, where they were bringing up, like, an old Noah tag where it was Kenta was in it and Yuji Nagata was on the other side of it. And Kenta apparently has a reputation. Well, I mean, he doesn't. He had a reputation for being sometimes a bully and a somewhat unsafe worker. And for anyone, like, Google, like, YouTube search Kenta tag Nagata, and you will see, like, a brief clip of Nagata just seeing that this guy's taking liberties with his partner, tagging in and, like, legit beating the shit out of Kenta. Like, and I kind of, like, watching this match after seeing that, it was just like, yeah, like, I can see it all with Kenta in matches like this, where even when I don't feel like he's being malicious, man, he walks that line sometimes. But anyway, I'll just say, I like Kenta matches where he's either completely dominating to a guy to the point where I feel like he's kind of being an asshole, or where he's facing another grumpy prick like him who's going to match him grumpiness for grumpiness, blow for blow. This match is neither. It's a little weird early on to see Sydal, who's starting to get a push in ROH at this point, but he wasn't on the level of Kenta's other ROH opponents. And he's, you know, Sydal's a great natural underdog. And this match, he's, like, shockingly going 50-50 with Kenta, like he's a total equal. Like, there's a point even where there's a strike exchange where Sydal wins the strike exchange to the point where, like, Jared David on commentary is, like, shocked. Like Matt Sydal just beat Kenta, like, in an exchange of blows. And then the middle of the match starts to shift a bit more. Kenta starts dominating again, you know. And the one thing that really stood out to me was near the end where Seidel turns a go to sleep into a Rana for a near fall. And it's the only spot in this match where it's like a little bit of a left turn, right? And it's a little unexpected, a little inventive, and it gets the biggest pop of the entire match. And the final minutes did start picking up, I think, where like Kenta really starts going in on Seidel. They really just start trading their absolute biggest moves. And it really starts getting more of an energy. And it kind of was sad in the sense of, I feel like they paced this match so it ended exactly where it felt like they were pacing it to end. Like it felt like a natural endpoint. But I also feel like the last minute or two was like, you were just hitting another level. And it was almost like, I wish you had paced the match differently, because I was like, I would call this like a strong, good, like a really high 3.5-star match. But like the last minute or two, it felt like, oh, this could be like a 4-star match. They're really hitting something here. And then it was just like, but it is kind of time to end this. But overall, this was probably my match of the show. And I mean, the Pele thing was more feel good, but in terms of action, you know, probably on the low end of Kenta matches in his entire Ring of Honor run, but still enjoyable to me. Albert, what did you see? You know, this is probably the first time you got to see Kenta live, I would imagine.
Yes, absolutely. It was. Yeah, I think this is an easy match of the show for me. I didn't think it was particularly close. Yeah, I really liked it. When I was searching, you know, as mentioned earlier, for some artifacts from the show and era, I found a picture I took of Kenta's entrance and the streamers, picture I took on my T-Mobile Sidekick that night. So that was really exciting to find documentation of. Yeah, I thought this was good. It's not great, maybe, you know, it doesn't quite reach that next level, but I thought it was really good. It certainly felt like a breath of fresh air in the wider context of the show. It was really cool seeing sort of a vintage Kenta. You know, obviously his wrestling has evolved quite a bit over the years, and seeing how fast and smooth he was back then. Obviously, you know, we all remember how exciting that was. And Matt Seidel was great too. And, you know, they're both still great in different ways, and it's cool seeing them back then. I did think it was interesting on the commentary that, you know, it seemed to me, and I look to both of you as the experts in the field, that they were positioning Seidel as obviously the underdog, but also kind of like more of like an up and comer than I expected.
Yeah,
because it was my impression that he, and I believe it is the case, had wrestled pretty extensively for ROH already at this point, and they were acting like, you know, people really see the potential in this guy. And I was like, oh, hasn't he been around for years at this point?
So he had been around for years, but I feel like it was really late 2005, so a year before this, that he was finally like regularly booked, I would say. And yes, but like it's true that throughout 2006, he was heavily featured, more than I even remembered, in like big matches right at the beginning. Like he was in some main events, he was in like a few featured matches, he got, you know, was runner up in Survival of the Fittest. So it was a very long, like, quote, up and comer period. But yeah, he got a pretty big singles push, and he was about to get a pretty big tag team push. So yeah, he was a big deal in ROH in 2006, I would say.
Yeah, and Matt, what did you think about the match as a whole? Like, you know, this is not us saying goodbye to Kenta. This is not a goodbye, it's us, catch you later. But we will not be seeing him for a while. So what did you think about this?
Yeah, I think probably the big difference in like how much you hated this show versus me disliking it but not feeling as strongly negative as you is probably this match and probably the previous one. Like, I thought this was a great match. Like, not like a high grade, like a low grade. I'd say Seidel, I think, bookended the year in Philadelphia with like that great match against Styles. I think this match was slightly below that one, but still like just really good and well executed, to the point where it felt like this show, like this match took place in another universe as the rest of the show. Like, this just felt like an ROH show just during this match. This was the only match on the show that felt like this was during an ROH show. So I feel like Daniels, you know, I mean, not Daniels, like Kenta's, you know, hard kick, Seidel's, you know, great finesse moves and great execution. And I didn't think, I really don't have anything negative to say. It didn't get to this extremely high level of drama or, you know, sort of innovation or anything, but it was a exciting, well-executed, great match, I would say. Like, just like what you'd want from this. It didn't go beyond necessarily what you would hope for, but I think it hit what I hoped for this match. And it was the only thing on the entire show that did.
So after the match, Kenta gets a standing ovation and chant from the crowd. Like, they know this is going to be it for him for a while. Kenta grabs the mic and he says in English, "Thank you, Philadelphia, and thank you, USA, and thank you, Ring of Honor." As Samoa Joe marches to the ring while this is happening, Joe grabs the mic and says he'd like to think he's a big enough man to admit when he was wrong, and tonight he is. Joe says when he started in Japan, he remembered Kenta back then. He was just starting. He had a lot of fire, but Joe didn't think much of him. And when Kenta first came to ROH, he still didn't think much of him then either. But Joe says, I've learned one thing during your stay in ROH, and that's you're Japan, if not the world's finest competitor. He says Kenta gave everything he had every night for the most dedicated fans in the world. And Joe says for that, domo arigato. He bows to Kenta, who bows back. Joe says because of that, he needs Kenta to take a message back to Noah from Joe and ROH. He says, I need you to take this message back to men like Morishima, to men like Kenta Kobashi, who Joe says, I hope when he hears it, he'll come back and give me my rematch. Joe says it's a message that transcends all language barriers. And Joe then slaps Kenta across the face, who immediately fires back. It turns into a big brawl on the mat as wrestlers immediately flood the ring to try and break it up. Joe goes to the floor. He looks very satisfied with himself. Kenta stays in the ring, gets another loud thank you, Kenta chant. And I thought on a night filled with in-ring angles and promos, this was exactly one of them that was good. I would say the big flaw in it was it's yet another angle that makes you really want to see Samoa Joe versus Kenta, which is a match we never get. But otherwise, I thought the emotion of this was good. I liked that Joe gave him respect and then kind of turned it into that intensity. Matt, before I ask you what you think about this, weird note I found looking through the Observer. This kind of changes how I think about some things, though. Meltzer wrote in the Observer, "The post-match of Kenta Seidel was more notable. As Samoa Joe said, when he first saw Kenta in Japan in ROH, he didn't think that much of him, but that he was man enough to say he was wrong. Then Joe said he had an important message to send to Morishima, Pro Wrestling Noah, and Kenta Kobashi, and slapped Kenta in the face. The actual line Joe was supposed to give was something to bury Kobashi to a degree by saying he was afraid to come back and face him, but either Joe didn't give it by accident or out of respect for Kobashi didn't want to give it. This turned into a pull apart. It will be several months, like maybe around March, before Kenta's back, as Noah's schedule for the next few months coincides with the ROH schedule. Relations between ROH and Noah are at their all-time best level." Wasn't Kobashi out with cancer? And didn't we get like a thing in the Observer like months ago that was basically saying like Noah was told like after Kobashi got cancer, like no matter what happens, Kobashi's like never coming back like to Ring of Honor, like to America ever again. And they're like I wonder if that is like if like Dave's theory there is true that like the reason why Joe didn't say something was like, you really want me to like be like this guy with cancer is a fucking pussy, like he's not gonna come back to America. Like, what a bizarre little wrinkle to that. I mean, what do you think, Matt?
So Gabe must have told Dave that, right? Like, who else would have, right? That like
Joe I don't know if Joe spoke today, but like, yeah, that's a weird thing to basically say, like he was supposed to kind of bury Kobashi and say, yeah, if you watch this promo, he does not do it. He basically just says, you know, I'm going to send a message, and I hope when you hear it, Kobashi comes back and gives me my rematch.
Yeah, I mean, he said it with a tone that you could maybe say was brash and disrespectful, but he didn't actually say anything like that. But you kind of took the words out of my mouth. Like, all the promos on this show, like, were terrible, except for this one. This was a perfectly good promo.
Yeah, the one. So, and that brings us to – let me just check my notes quickly to make sure I don't miss anything. Yeah, it brings us to the main event. First, we get a little hype video for the Homicide versus Carino main event. The on-screen graphic mentions how the four-year war will end tonight. And I actually think this was the last time these two ever wrestled each other, at least in Ring of Honor. So, like, this is some rare truth in advertising and wrestling. Like, this really was the end. And that brings us to the fight without honor. Homicide, scored to the ring by Julie Smokes, defeated Steve Carino, scored to the ring by Ricky Landell, and strangely enough, as Matt, you pointed out earlier, ROH referee Mike Keener definitely not being objective, like showing up as a second for Steve Carino, and Homicide wins by pinfall in 26-42 after he hit a lariat. Albert, as the guest, I think you should get the honor of going first on this. You've probably seen some pretty violent matches as a regular PWG attendee. Like, you know, there's been some guerrilla warfare matches, but I have to imagine, like, this is probably ranks up pretty high. Albert, this is a match that scared away a grandmother from the front row. I mean, if we'll get to that later, but
think we should open there because the commentary played it out as if it was so violent that the elderly lady from the front row was just disgusted. But to be quite frank, she almost got hit by that trash can. It was right near her.
Before that, I rewound. Like, if you watch when someone gets Irish whipped into the barricade, like, it hits right, it, like, pushes in on her, and she gets, like, startled, and, like, she flinches. Like, I felt bad for her.
Yeah, I think, you know, there were some very specific reasons why she might have wanted to move from where she was, other than just the general violence. But, yeah. You know, I have seen some violent matches in my time. I've been to a lot of GCW shows out here in LA as well. A lot of light tubes and such. So, you know, in a way, it's interesting, Greg, because this feels somewhat tame in, you know, current context. But also, this match, you know, I think it's fair to say in many ways it was not these two great men's finest moment. It was long, it was pretty slow, and it really didn't hold my interest in a lot of ways rewatching it. And I'm fairly sure back in 2006, I wasn't that excited about it either. And yeah, I mean, there's some parts of it that are neat. You know, Homicide takes a pretty strong bump onto a ladder. And, you know, yeah, I just overall, I think this was, you know, not for me. And I don't think I'm alone there.
Yeah, Matt, we've been through we've now seen rewatched the entire feud. I think, in my opinion, I'm going to ask if you agree, and I want your thoughts on the overall match, obviously. But I'm just going to say, after rewatching all of it, I feel confident in saying that my memories were confirmed, which is like Homicide versus Carino. It is, Albert, I don't know if you know, it's the very prestigious through the years honors, you know, our end of the year awards we get every year to Ring of Honor. Their match at Bitter Friends, Stiffer Enemies, what a great show title, was our consensus 2003 Ring of Honor match of the year. Matt and I give individual awards, but sometimes we agree. And they wrestled before that match, they wrestled after that match, and I think it's safe to say, like, the War of the Wire match was entertaining in its own right, but it's just a weird feud where they had one match where they had this magic. And I think it's easy to say now, I don't think they ever found that magic ever again. Like, right, Matt?
I don't know if I totally agree. Like, okay, so I don't think they ever hit that level ever again. But I think the War of the Wire match, and you know that I think this, maybe I'm like on an island here, but I think their Steel Cage Warfare match, they both had something odd and special about them. Even though they weren't great in the same way that first match was, they both felt unique. They both had an aura to them. This match absolutely did not. I don't know. Before I continue, like, do you have anything you want to say to what I just said? Because I know that's, like, maybe controversial. I don't know.
No, I don't think that's completely controversial. And I think it's interesting because I think from the sounds of what Albert said and now what you're saying, I think I'm not going to be a high rating of this match. I think I'm going to be the high vote on this match, actually.
Well, okay. So I think that this match was, to me, you know, and maybe it's, you know, giving excuses, but to me, this match was poisoned by the angles leading up to it. I think they could have gotten to a point where a final Carino versus Homicide match mattered a lot more to the fans than this one seemed to. I think that they could have created an aura for this match that would have been fitting to, you know, the intensity of the feud. But instead, they had it sort of overshadowed by Cornette. They had Carino kind of taking this weird, like, over-the-top heelish, I'm just going to say horrible, offensive things to the audience all the time, and that's going to be my character, and, like, just take away the charm that he had previously had. And I think all of that kind of worked against this match and made it so that it didn't lead to a match that I think lived up to what these two are capable of. I thought it was a weird mess, I guess, is what I would say. There was a segment in the match that I do think worked, which was the spot in the middle of the match where Homicide kept pulling out escalating weapons and you know, and doing things with that, whether it be like, you know, the barbed wire bat and a bunch of tables and prime the ladder, and like the crowd got into that and I got into that. The beginning was a little bit slow. The ending felt extremely abrupt and not particularly hot. I remember there was a spot where Homicide poured rubbing alcohol onto Carino's busted up ear, if you remember that. I remember us talking about how the rubbing alcohol must have actually been water. So I remember thinking like, oh no, Steve Carino is going to get water stuck in his ear like he was in the swimming pool. That was something I was worried about because, again, I'm a mother, I guess. And another spot that I strongly remember, Homicide put Carino on a table on the floor and hit a frog splash to the floor through the table. And that was – I thought that was a really cool move. And Smoke yells, I like this gangsta shit. And then I was like, gangsters are known for jumping off high things through tables. And then I thought to myself, wait a minute. He was probably talking about the tag team, the gangsters, because exactly. They actually are known for jumping off high things through tables. So I corrected myself and I realized that is something that was apropos indeed. So I apologize to you, Julia Smokes, for ever doubting you. But yeah, I thought like a lot of the strike battles they had got no heat. I thought, you know, like you said, the ending where they put the table on top and then Homicide kind of caught Carino on the top and DDT'd him through the table. And then the lariat, it was like, I don't know, just the crowd wasn't ready for it, even though the match was really long. There was another moment where Carino got a two count off of what looked to me like a regular clothesline. And David goes, Homicide just kicked out of that huge lariat. I felt sad when Carino hit the old school expulsion and not a single person in the crowd made a sound. Like, that made me sad. There was just a lot about this match that I felt sad about. And, you know, you'll probably get into all the unprotected chair shots to the head since I know you mentioned them earlier. But I think that this match deserved better. I really did like that, how crazy that Steel Cage Warfare match was, even though that was also a mess and Homicide got hurt on it. It felt crazy and wild and out of control. So like Albert was talking about at the end, they talked about how disturbing and violent this match was, and it seemed tame by modern standards. I just got to tell you, Albert, it seemed tame by the standards of the other three matches these guys had in ROH previously. Like, it wasn't near the most violent match that Homicide's even had in 2006, never mind in wrestling in general. So, yeah, weird match, disappointing to me in a lot of ways. I did think there were a couple of cool things, but yeah, I think I'm with Albert overall.
I appreciate that insight, and now I know I'm not just a sicko.
Well, I actually like this match a little more than both of you. I think it's one of those weird examples where I remember really disliking this match, and I know the reputation of this match. So it's like after years of disliking, of knowing, I remember, oh, that's a match I really disliked. Like, I came back and it was almost like it was an easy bar to clear. It was like, well, it's not as bad as I remembered it. It still wasn't good. This match is a hard one for me to rate because there were moments I liked. And there were moments I was completely numb to, and there were moments like you, Matt, that actually made me sad, which is a strange emotion I don't get often watching wrestling, where I'm like, oh, I'm not just like bored or annoyed, I'm sad. But our future listeners who listen back to the show, like in bunkers in the year war torn year of like 2085, they might not know this, but there was a time when you had to like listen to a radio station, you had to tune it in, you had to like twirl a knob till you got the station signal zeroed in. And if you were just a little off, it sounded bad, but you could still hear the station. It'd just be lower quality, have a little bit of static. And if you were really off, you might still barely be able to hear the station, but still have a lot of noise on top. And to me, this match, and really the whole feud after Bitter Friends, Different Enemies, is like these two guys trying to tune a radio to get back to Bitter Friends, Different Enemies. And sometimes for a minute or two or a sequence here or there, they get it right on. And then sometimes, a lot of the time, they're a little bit off. And then sometimes, a lot of the time, they're completely off and you can just barely hear it. And yeah, this match, I think you see it all. It has that similar kind of brutal and unrelenting pace of this Bitter Friends match. Like, these two are never in a rush, but I also didn't think, like, there's ever a spot where they're just doing nothing. Yes, like, I thought, like, you guys are saying it wasn't that violent, seems quaint. I thought there was still, like, this was a pretty violent match. Like, you get every piece of plunder you could ask for. Both guys bleed. Like, Homicide's blade job is not as good as the Bitter Friends one, but still pretty good.
But when you compare it to their other matches, Trevor, like, I don't think it was as violent.
The table bumps were pretty – two of the more brutal table bumps we've seen in Ring of Honor. Like, those felt very like, Jesus, I wouldn't want to take those. Like, the frog splash Homicide does off the top through the table on the floor, and then Creel taking the DDT off the top through a table in the ring. I thought those were, like, gnarly table bumps. There's a million shots to the head that are completely unprotected. This was definitely, like, pre-Benoit wrestling where wrestlers were still like, yeah, concussions aren't real. Like, you can just ignore them. But, like, the thing this match was missing, I thought, that makes it bad, is the Bitter Friends match is drenched in hate. Like, the hate's the start of the show. Like, there's a lot of weapons in that match. There's a lot of gore. But the hate, like, it feels like all that's in service of the story. It's in service of the vibe of these two guys just hate each other. They have just such distaste for each other. And this match doesn't have that hate, especially for a match that's supposed to be the blow off of a 4-year, like, long on again, off again feud. Like, Carino rarely shows emotion in this match, and Homicide shows, like, a few bursts of it, but the match is, like, strangely, like, emotionally flat for a lot of it. And without that anger, this match does start to feel like what the other match wasn't, which is a long series of just, okay, let's check off the boxes. This piece of plunder. Let's fight in the crowd for a while. Let's do some near falls. Like, it feels like a way death matches sometimes can feel, which is just, we got a list of props. Let's go through them one by one. Even the crowd, like, a lot of this match, it has this feeling of, like, resignation. Like, oh, we have to do all this shit because it's what people expect from us. Like, even the crowd feels resigned where they're not reacting very loud to this match. But at the end, like, they give, like, a polite, decent applause as soon as the match ends. Almost like, well, you bled a lot. You took a lot of crap. So, like, we owe you this much. The part of the match that really worked for me, actually, was the start. There was a somber tone they found that kind of worked for me at the start where, like, Carino, you've never seen him like that. Like, he's not reacting at all to his ring introduction. It's almost like he's, like, just mentally preparing himself, like, this is gonna suck. And then we get this very lengthy tentative stare down from across the ring after the bell, like they're almost afraid again of, like, starting this all back up again. And then they lock up, and, you know, people oftentimes have said, like, oh, I hate when, like, really grudge, when big grudge matches start with a lockup, because that's what you wouldn't do in a fight. You wouldn't start with a lockup. And usually I agree, but this was a match where I actually really liked the lockups, because, like, they were very struggling. Creel's, like, screaming in them. Like, they feel very forceful and gritty. And then the first couple things happen in this match are Homicide slaps Carino in the ear, which is, you know, Bitter Friends match. Carino legit loses his hearing in that ear because Homicide catches him.
They've called back to that basically every match they've had with each other since then, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I still enjoy it. And then right after that, Homicide tears off the tape on his shoulder, which is the shoulder he hurt in, obviously, the Steel Cage Warfare. So I liked that they were very quickly referencing, like, okay, like, here we both really have screwed each other up. But then after that, yeah, the match then just becomes – the emotion is just drained, and it just becomes the plunder match. And we get that long section of crowd brawling around the building, and it's not great. It's not bad. It's fine. We get to ringside. We get all the plunder. And again, I will say, this match does not skip on the plunder. You get the bump on the ladder. You get all the chair shots to the head. You get a ghetto fork, a tennis racket, the rubbing alcohol spot, the two brutal table spots. You know, they do a fair bit of stuff, and the grandma spots, which – if anyone knows that poor, rarely on Through the Years have we ever seen a woman or anyone that old in the front row. And this poor woman, the guy gets whipped right in front of her. She gets scared. Then a guy gets hit with a head with a garbage can right in front of her. And she like, the commentary acknowledges, like, oh, that woman's leaving. I felt so bad for her. But it just, yeah, this match just doesn't have that emotional peak you want for a match that's supposed to end this feud. I think, Matt, your point about it, like, probably being also hurt by just how bad the angles were tonight that killed the show. That's
not just tonight, in the months leading up to this. If they had centered Carino instead of Cornette over the previous few months, and he didn't go for this cheap version of himself, I think they could have actually done some good stuff over the past few months. I just think the Cornette, approach was a mistake, and you live and learn, I guess.
Yeah, and the part of the match that made me sad was the same part that made you sad, where they do finally near the end try and go for this epic feel where they're hitting these big moves and they keep kicking out at one, like the Northern Lights bomb and the old school expulsion and stuff like that. And it actually backfires because this crowd pops almost not at all for these one counts. It's supposed to be these big moments of holy shit, this is the end of everything. They're doing the biggest stuff and kicking out at one. And the crowd just doesn't give a shit. And Albert, you said, this match was long, and that's one of the most common criticism of this match. But the weird thing is that Bitter Friends match is universally pretty liked by people who like that style of match. We loved it. And it's only 2 or 3 minutes shorter than this match. But yet this match feels so much longer because I feel it's missing that hate. And the crowd for that show was really into the match. The crowd in this show is not into it. Overall, there were still elements of it. The radio tuned in enough for me in little moments where I'd give this a flat 3 stars. But that's really disappointing in saying, well, these are two guys are capable of. I went back, I looked over the notes for some of the prior Carino Homicide matches that I had for the podcast we did. And it's interesting that, Matt, the match right before Homicide and Carino at Bitter Friends, Stiffer Enemies is the very first ROH match between Samoa Joe versus CM Punk. And I remember that match. That match is nothing special. And then they'd go on to have these amazing matches afterwards. And the Homicide Carino match on that night is amazing. And, we might disagree on how good some of the matches are after that, but they never have a match that good again. It's almost like that night they switched places afterwards, And it's just really – and also the Briscoes interfere at one point in this match, so we get more interference. But, just a weird – it's just a – you know what? It gets weirder because we still have to go to the post-match. So
boy, does it after get the weirder. Match,
Yeah, absolutely. After the match – Homicide grabs the mic. He asks ring announcer Bobby Cruz where some bag is. Cruz retrieves it from under the ring, and Homicide calls Cruz a snitch and an F-slur ass announcer, which felt really mean. I guess maybe he's playing off the fact that Bobby Cruz used to be Steve Carino's personal ring announcer, but he hasn't had that association for a while now.
Right. You'd have to really know that, or else. Even with that, it doesn't totally make sense, but. I guess maybe the implication is that Cruz was hiding that stuff for Carino.
Yeah.
I don't even know.
Which is weird. Also, how does Homicide know that Carino has a electric razor under the ring?
That's weird.
Doesn't make sense. Anyway, Homicide pulls an electric razor out from the bag as Julius Smokes keeps shouting O.J. Simpson for some reason. Did he think he's going to cut him with it? I don't know. Homicide says they went on each other as a shoot in the most hated feud, which, by the way, that's Homicide's phrasing, not mine, not the most hateful feud, the most hated feud, not just in Ring of Honor, but all over the world. Homicide says there's a tradition in Mexico that you shave your opponent's head at the end of a feud, and that's what he's going to do to Carino right now, or his homeboys are going to fuck Carino up, and that's a shoot. Carino grabs the mic, and he starts to respond when a heckler must be telling Carino to shut up, and Carino angrily tells the fan to, shut up, or I'm going to take you outside and beat your fat ass, and Carino seems, genuinely mad, because, this is supposed to be, the big – oh, go on.
I was going to say, both guys seem pissed, and I almost wonder if they're just, mad that the match didn't get over.
Yeah, they seem unhappy, and Carino seems especially mad that, the fans are heckling what's supposed to be, the big emotional, cathartic end to this. At this point, Homicide's posse of Conan and Ricky Reyes, they've joined Smokes on the outside. Carino says, it's been 4 years. Carino says, when Gabe first told me about, hey, I want to pair you with Homicide, I said, are you kidding? He's a street thug. Carino says, I wouldn't even allow Homicide in my town. And I wrote my notes – as I was like recapping this, like listening to it at the time, that's an incredibly racist dog whistle of a comment on this show, which is somehow like the fifth most racist thing that's been said. And then the very next line Carino says is, I'm a white boy from the suburbs, 800 people in my town. We don't accept your kind of my town. And then I wrote my notes. Okay, that's raising this up the list. Like just when I'm like, okay, yeah, that's pretty bad, but it could be worse. It then got worse.
Right. The post-match where he's trying to like get sympathy, he just decides to like double down on the racism.
Like again, when the racism has not like worked the entire night, and then he goes, there is this funny moment though at this point where Creel says, you know, I've wrestled every major star in this sport, and it's clear that like Creel's starting, like you could see it coming from a mile away, he's starting the promo turn where he's calling down Homicide, but now he's going to give him his props. And Homicide is either oblivious to this or just being Homicide, because Creel's starting to be like, you know, I've wrestled every major star, and Homicide just interrupts and goes, I don't give a fuck. And Creel has to remind him, like very calmly, he's like, I'm still cutting a promo. And then he just keeps going. And Carino goes, I've wrestled your idol, Homicide, Terry Funk. I've wrestled Dusty Rhodes. I've wrestled Shinya Hashimoto. And there's no one tougher than Homicide. And that gets like a legit awe from the crowd, which was kind of adorable. And Steve says, we're never going to see eye to eye. We're never going to share Thanksgiving dinner together. But if Homicide wants to shave my head, I'm man enough to start it myself. And Carino then grabs the razor and he starts shaving his own head. And Homicide goes, what the fuck? So Carino sits down in a chair in the middle of the ring. Homicide tries to say something on the mic. The mic doesn't work. He kicks it. And like at that point, the mic starts working because you can hear it like hit the mat. The crowd starts laughing at that. Homicide goes, the boogeyman must be here. And I don't know if he was meaning the wrestling boogeyman. I don't know if he was around yet, or the fabled boogeyman.
The wrestler boogeyman was definitely around.
Okay, so I don't know which one he was referencing. Homicide then tells Carino he respects him, and then he says something I can't make out and calls Carino stupid. So like it's this weird mix of like praise, racism, and hatred by two guys that know this isn't getting over. It's like an incredibly weird vibe. And then Homicide starts shaving Carino's head as Smokes asks, and then Smokes is like telling Homicide to like scalp Carino, and Carino just looks so unhappy at this point. Homicide tries to use the mic again. It doesn't work again. Homicide's posse takes turns shaving Carino's head as Homicide, frustrated with the mic not working, shouts, and I quote, what kind of company is this that's making so much money? This segment is going so bad. And then at one point, in what may be my favorite moment of this entire awful fucking show, Homicide gets the second mic, and you can hear a fan shout, that's the crappy one they gave to Conan. And I just started laughing because that is, in fact, the crappy one they gave to Conan. And I love that it's like so apparent that even the fans are like aware of this. Like, yeah, you don't want to use that one. Homicide says, you know, not being welcome in Carino's town is fine. He is kind, is separate from Carino's kind, but he has respect for Carino. And, you know, you shake my hand like a goddamn man, and the Carino Homicide era is over. They shake hands. Matt, this was a fucking mess. What the fuck was
this? Yeah, I mean, but was there any more appropriate way to end this show? Like, it's just like everything that could go wrong did. And the crowd was confused. The wrestlers seemed completely confused. I got to imagine the booker was confused. I don't know what to say about any of this. It was just, I've never seen a show from a major promotion, and you could tell me if you can disagree with this. I've never seen a show from a major promotion with across the board such bad promos, like from top to bottom, from people who have given good promos plenty of times. Like everything just went terribly. Like forget the wrestling for a second. Just the angles and mic work on this show were historically bad. I don't know if you agree with me.
I agree. I like the part at the very end of the Carino promo where he put Homicide over as tougher than legends. Like that was legitimately kind of touching. But everything else here, like I wrote in my notes, everything else here was the worst of everyone involved. Like you got the edgelord racism from Carino, which he could drop into. Homicide's obsession that he has sometimes with constantly saying something as a shoot over and over again. The Ring of Honor production being horrible with the mics not working constantly. And even the crowd like heckling Carino when this was supposed to clearly be the big – like everyone – fucked up here. It was just the worst of everybody. It was like the cherry on top of the shit sundae of the entire Cornette homicide feud. And Albert, before I ask you what you think about this, I'll just point out, Matt, you said something, I don't know if you know this, but you were very, you mentioned just now, even the Booker was probably wondering what was going on. You don't know, you might not know how right you are, because we'll go to the Observer. Meltzer wrote, "The Philadelphia main event was a weapons-filled bloodbath, more akin to a CZW match, including pouring rubbing alcohol in open cuts, with Homicide beating Steve Carino. Match was a stiff fight, but only got a so-so reaction. Homicide then said Mexican tradition is at the end of the feud, the loser gets his head shaved. He said that he and Carino had feuded for 4 years and said Carino was getting his head shaved or they would fuck him up for real. Carino then put Homicide over as his toughest opponent, and they shook hands to end the feud, although both said they still hated each other. Carino then started to shave his head, and Homicide finished the job. Carino apparently wants to change his look. It didn't really get over." And then the PGW Insider then adds, "As mentioned in our coverage of last night's Philadelphia event, Homicide shaving Steve Carino's head last night after their match was kept a secret from most, including Booker Gabe Sapolsky. They basically had carte blanche to book their own match. The idea was that Homicide had won the feud after all these years, and like the famous Latino wrestlers of the past, he was going to take Carino's hair." So apparently, yeah, like even Gabe did not know, like, I guess Carino wanted to change his look, and they were just like, well, yeah, we're going to shave head. And then they do this whole fucking thing. And just more bizarre on top of more bizarre. Albert, did you have any thoughts watching this either at the time or now? Because does this come off as weird to you as it comes off to two guys who are rewatching every show?
Probably weirder. Truly a cursed ending, a feel bad ending to a disappointing show. You know, as noted, even the handshake between the two of them, which should feel like some sort of closure, resolution to this feud. It feels like both of them hate doing it, and that things haven't really changed from that storyline perspective between them. And yeah, and really feels almost beyond parody that at the tail end of the show, they squeeze in more racism with Steve Carino bragging about being from a sundown town. It was a mess, as noted. And, you know, I think watching it this past week, I was really kind of trying to think about how I felt at the time, because I don't really remember. And I do think, and you know, Matt's got a better memory than me. I think I was just sort of excited to go to a show like that. I hadn't really ever been, I think the only other like really non-WWE show I had been to at that point was like a very small indie show at like a bar in Arizona. So certainly seeing all of these guys for the first time, I think I was still, even though I certainly wasn't like buzzing with excitement, I think I was just excited to be there. And I wish I could still, summon that type of youthful optimism now.
Well, I'm glad if nothing else that I thought this is horrible for this to be your first Ring of Honor show, but in a way that like, I didn't think of it that way, where like at least the novelty could help kind of carry you through it, as opposed to like Matt, who had already at this point been to a lot of Ring of Honor shows. It was probably like, boy, I picked the wrong one to bring a friend to.
Yeah, so, I was embarrassed. But the good news is Albert came back the following year, brought him to a couple shows. They were better. So that at least ended better. I didn't leave Albert with this as his only ROH experience, I guess, which is nice.
No spoilers, but we went to Glory by Honor Nights 1 and 2 in 2007. And I remember after those shows, I was like giddy with excitement. And I didn't feel that way after this one.
Yeah. You're like, wow, the Ring of Honor isn't a promotion where it's racist every time. And Matt just wrapped a blanket around you to keep you warm and said, no, Albert, just some of the time. And you walked away having a good night. But we have a couple more notes left. PW Torch wrote at the time, Now that the Steve Carino vs. Homicide feud is over, Gabe Sapolsky says there's still a place for Carino in Ring of Honor. Quote, Carino is a great talent that has a lot to offer, whether it be wrestling or promos or pulling off angles. If the right role comes up for him, then you can expect to see him back in ROH. And here's why I will tell you that Steve Carino does not come back ever again in the Gabe Sapolsky era of Ring of Honor, which is another 2 years about. So,
but he does have a major role in other eras.
Yes, absolutely. He does, you know, become part of a stable, you know, becomes a commentator, but just gave us 2 more years. This is it for him in here. We then go backstage to see a furious Colt Cabana, who calls Jimmy Jacobs a mascara-wearing, colored hair, frickin' dressed little punk, Colt says, fumbling the last words of his line. Colt says he's cool with whatever Jimmy wants to be as long as he's on the level. But Jimmy is way past the level. Colt says he took Jimmy in, he befriended him, he tagged with him, he pushed the love triangle away and was willing to take Jimmy in, and Jimmy double-crossed him. Jimmy couldn't put his demons aside, as weird as he is. He says Jimmy wants to be a real heel. He used a heel on my eye. Well, my eye gets better and I can see past things. Jimmy, you can't see past things. You can't see past anything. It's sick. I don't care anymore. You're hiding behind Lacey. And he goes, if Lacey wants to push my buttons by bragging about her money and her power, if Lacey thinks she's going to end my career and break my leg like she did to Whitmer. And then at this point, BJ Whitmer walks into frame and Colt says, speak of the devil. BJ says, I know about from our wars, you and me, Colt, just how tough you are. And if you ever need someone to get your back, I've got it. Colt laughs and he says, that means you, sweetheart. And he blows a kiss into the camera. This was one of Colt's serious promos. I actually thought parts of it were pretty good, but also had this weird, again, like a lot of things this night, a weird mix of energy where he was also trying to work in a lot of very cute, almost jivey, Dusty Rhodes-ish wordplay while doing this like angry, kind of like, I'm going to get you promo. And it was, again, just, I felt like a really weird mix. Like, am I crazy for thinking that?
Well, also, like, it felt like this, he could have put this promo, like, on the show where he got beat up, or on this last show. Like, he was just like happy-go-lucky Colt Cabana for the last two shows after the whole angle with Jimmy Jacobs. And then suddenly he's just furious here. Like, I don't know. It felt like weirdly timed, I guess. The promo itself, I didn't really have a problem with, but the timing after we just saw him being goofy and silly felt strange to me.
Yeah. And speaking of odd, We then cut to a very bummed out looking Steve Corino with his head shaved in the ring as the crowd chants for him. And this only lasts for a few seconds. And that's how they decide to end the show. And I will just say, we're going to use, I'll have to hunt down the pic of Albert getting high fived.
He sent it on the Facebook Messenger chat.
If great.
You didn't see it. Yeah.
That's awesome. I hardly ever check Facebook. So you
don't even have to send anything. It's there.
Perfect. So I will just say there was also a rare episode where there was two other good examples I almost could have used, if not the Albert one's clearly the best one, but like the grandmother getting scared or Steve Corino looking about as depressed as a wrestler looks, like just at the end of the show. But with all that being said, Matt, before we get to final thoughts and plugs, the most important part of the show, it's time for the Matt F. Trophy, and boy, is this a show to give away the Matt? And I'll just have people inform Matt, inform to us, Matt and me today. The real life Matt F. trophies are growing exponentially. There was one, there's now two. So coming soon might be just multiple Matt F. trophies.
Well, I mean, as you know, as much as I could say, like, oh gosh, what could I give the trophy to? I actually think the choice is pretty obvious here. I'm giving it to Pele Primo for making us feel good for once in our damn lives. Thank you, Pele.
Ellie, thank you for giving us a small, I almost feel like I should personally thank him. Like, thank you. Like, you honestly gave me like one thing to enjoy on this show, but
he's listened to our shows before, so he might hear this. So thank you, Pelly.
And that brings us to the end of the show. Albert, what'd you think about, again, I want to say one more time, I apologize you had to rewatch this show. This is honestly, in my opinion, the worst. We've done 100. We've rewatched all 125 of the first Ring of Honor shows. It is, in my opinion, this is the worst show we've seen.
I mean, that feels notable. I'm happy to be here on such a conspicuous episode. Yeah, it really is interesting looking back because I don't think I thought it was so bad at the time. And I think a lot of that probably comes down to, like I said, I was just excited because of the novelty of it and seeing all these people live for the first time who I was already fans of. And also, I guess my taste in wrestling not being as refined at that point. But I will say, you know, it was obviously not a stellar program. But what was great, that very same weekend, that me and Matt saw Ring of Honor's The Bitter End, was we saw a film together on its opening weekend in movie theaters, and we both had a great time. And I know Matt remembers what movie it is. But Trevor, do you want to guess what film we saw the weekend of Ring of Honor's The Bitter End? Think about November 2006. Think of some big box office sensations around that time.
Sallow, Showa.
None of these were in 2006, but we all would have had a great time if they were.
I'm just trying to think, what's the most depressing things you could be seeing if on a revival? But no, what did you guys go and see?
Wait, can I give you a hint?
Okay.
It was very nice.
can I also give a hint? Instead,
yes.
I saw it with Matt. I did not see it with my wife.
You know, honestly, the podcast always make the shows better, but I feel like we could have had a better time just talking for 3 hours about your guys' weekend together and Borat.
I mean, Borat is extremely funny, both the character and the film.
Yes.
Still to this day.
What I will say is this was not as good as Borat. The way I would tell it before throwing it to you, Matt, is sometimes on the show occasionally we will have a show where we'll go, the wrestling was good or average, but you know what selling elevates the show, whether it's like a special moment or an angle or a promo or just some historical significance or a vibe, where I feel like this is the rare example of the opposite, where this was a not good show from a bell-to-bell standpoint, but there was a couple in pretty good matches, you know, and one that, Matt, you found actually great. I could probably find a worse show in through the years history from a strictly bell to bell standpoint. Probably not too many, but I probably could find one. But when you add in the angles being so horrible, so prevalent, how much of a bummer two different feuds or storylines ended in the worst possible way, the all-time record level of racism, and it's not even close, and it didn't even get any reaction, just the number of things that were disappointing that didn't make sense. It's like, I really do think this is the worst show we've ever seen. Like, I told you this before. After one segment, I had to go quickly to, like, I was watching a segment, trying to squeeze it in, part of watching this, like, during the week. I had to then go out and, like, run some errands. When I got in my car, this never happens to me, I was actively angry. Like I had not just anger from watching wrestling, but, like, anger that lingered for, like, 10 to 15 minutes, where I was, like, actively grumpy. And that never happens. Like, pro wrestling is a goofy entertainment. And I was, like, getting mad at myself for getting mad. I was, like, why do I care? And, like, I remember telling you this week, and you were, like, Trevor, this show happened, like, a decade and a half ago. You've seen before.
Closer to 2 decades, even, than a decade
and a half. Yeah, and yet I just did not remember. I knew it was not a good show. I just did not remember how bad it was. And I had to relive it again. The podcast, as always, makes it worth it. But in my opinion, I'm going to give this the rare – I don't know if I've ever done this. I usually give some kind of qualifier whenever you, like, you don't watch this unless you're a hardcore fan or if you like this specific wrestler or just watch this one match. I'm going to give this a rating of do not watch this show.
See, when a show is that bad, I mean, just like bad movies, I almost feel like if you love ROH, you maybe should watch it. Like, just
yeah,
to see
maybe
how low it can go. I think what, like, you know, I don't know if I'm as unequivocal about it being the worst as you, but, like, I get what you're saying, and I do think that the vibes are so bad, and that makes it even worse. You know what I mean? Like, it's just a feel-bad show all around. And, you know, like, I think you agree with me, but definitely for me, I'm an admirer of Gabe Sapolsky's booking. I think he did an incredible job, like, building this company and really influencing the future of wrestling with his booking. And this has got to be his lowest hour as far as, you know, I mean, listen, we all have failures in life, and, you know, he had a lot of successes in terms of, in my opinion, like what he was able to achieve creatively. And this was just not it. And I'm sure he knows it. And I'm sure that, you know, like, it was just a weird mix of WWE-esque with, like, also letting the inmates run the asylum. No TNA puns intended, Albert. Yeah, I mean, it was just and then, you know, terrible promo work from people who should be better at promos than this, and you put that all together and it's just like, ugh. what is this and how did it happen? And I hope it never happens again.
And the crazy thing to think about too is, like, I'm not talking about the post-match of the Cage of Death match of Death Before Dishonor, but just the match itself and everything that led up to it. One could argue that, like, Gabe Sapolsky's finest hour as a booker happened just a few months before in the same building. And then the very next time they come back, you could argue this is his worst hour.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it's crazy to think about. So, that brings us to the end of the show. That brings us to plugs. Albert, is there anything you would like to plug? Why are comic books so expensive now?
Supply chain issues. General inflation. Paper is expensive. Shipping is expensive. If we wanted to talk to the comics production and distribution podcast, we should just keep rolling because I know that's going to fascinate people. But no, I don't have anything specific to plug. I don't really post on X anymore. I think the last couple times I have, it was to respond to you, Trevor. I remember we were talking about Arliss being in WCW.
Oh, yeah.
And I also defended the crowd at Full Gear 2023 as being, in fact, good and not bad. But I'm on Blue Sky, so if you want to find me on Blue Sky, I'll love getting more followers there. There doesn't seem to be much wrestling chatter there yet, and there might never be. But, you can always hope for the future. But, yeah, beyond that, I would just like to plug my good friends Trevor and Matt and the concept of friendship and friendship that has lasted as long as ours have. I think that's the ultimate plug.
See Homicide, and Carino, that's how you do a heartwarming ending.
Yeah, I will just say I never talk to almost any of my old friends except via podcasts or Twitter comments. So thank you, the internet. That's helping me get over my crippling fear of letting anyone down. Anyway. So throughtheyears@gmail.com if you want to write us. If you know who that old woman was, please tell me. THROH for throughtheyears@gmail.com. Twitter @TrevorDame @MayorMGF. Until next time, next time we will be covering Black Friday Fallout, which might be the worst name for Ring of Honor show I've ever heard. Matt, I'm not a cage match ratings absolutist. I think sometimes, cage match ratings can be wrong. But I will say during this dry winter of Ring of Honor shows we've been covering, they've been pretty in sync with our thoughts. I'll say this. Black Friday Fallout has barely a higher overall show rating than this show. We could be in for some of the darkest hours of this podcast, because I don't know how much more I can take this. I mean, we're not going to stop the podcast, but
Trevor, I was at a lot of these shows. I was at the next two shows as well. I remember this era very well. I definitely knew this run was going to be bad. And I will tell you, it doesn't get much better until Final Battle. And even after Final Battle, they don't really snap out of this funk until the 50-year festival. And once Steen and Generico come in, we're off to the races. But you're gonna have a rough next year, I would say, Trevor.
Well, everyone, with that happy note to end the happy episode. Enjoy, people who ever thought, this is just a podcast where they're so positive all the time. You like listening to those podcasts where people then are unhappy sometimes. Enjoy the next year, and until next time, have a good time. Have a great time.